only. You should always seek your own independent legal opinion. Now, next weekend, I'm on Saturday and Sunday. In fact, on Saturday and Sunday, the weekend after as well. So you can catch me at 9 p.m. on both evenings for 2 hours of the LBC Consumer Hour. In the meantime, if you've missed any of tonight's show, you can listen back on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app, where you can stay up to date with the all the latest news and opinion, put your news categories in the order you want, pause and rewind live radio, and listen to a range of podcasts. Download the all-new official LBC app for free now. Coming up at 1, it's Richard Spur, but next here on LBC, it's Nick Abbott.
Thank you, Dean. A packed programme tonight. We will talk about how the major political parties are doing and why the party's favourability seems to be at odds with the popularity of their leaders. The value of meat sales has gone up, says The Telegraph, but is that because more of us are buying it? And is veganism really declining as it suggests? Sadiq Khan told LBC about the hurt that he still feels after suffering racism in his youth. We'll talk about that. We'll get the weather update as Christmas approaches. Check in with our US correspondent for the latest from there. But first, we'll have the latest on the shootings at Bondi Beach and Brown University. All that and more with me, Nick Abbott, after the new news at 10 on LBC.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom. Police investigating the Bondi Beach terror attack on a Jewish celebration in Australia say the perpetrators were a father and son. The 50-year-old was shot dead while his 24-year-old accomplice is under guard in hospital after 15 others were killed. Mal Lanyon is the Commissioner for New South Wales Police.
16 deceased persons is obviously a great tragedy for this state. Our thoughts, prayers and love go out to all of the families of the deceased. We pray that those who are injured recover quickly. I have two police officers currently in hospital at the moment. Both are in critical but stable condition. And again, the thoughts of the New South Wales Police are very much with those officers and their families.
Around 100 people have gathered in central London this evening for a vigil for the dead. It was held outside Australia House after being organised by the group Stop Hate UK. Rachel Cunliffe is from the New Statesman. She's been telling LBC anti-Semites have been using the IDF's actions in Gaza to justify their increasing hatred.
To make that connection, to the implication that perhaps those people who died somehow deserved it in some way because they believe in a religion that is part of a wider religious conflict that people feel very strongly about. I cannot imagine that argument being made about any other ethnic group.
And there'll be more about the Bondi Beach terror attack with Nick Abbott here on LBC in the next few minutes. The Home Office says more than 700 migrants arrived in the UK from France on Saturday. They made the journey using 11 boats after a 28-day period when no crossings were recorded. It's being reported Ukraine's president has dropped his push for Kyiv to join NATO. Volodymyr Zelensky made the announcement while travelling to meetings with the Trump administration for discussions on Washington's plan to end the war with Russia. Hannah Hopko from the International Centre for Ukrainian Victory has told LBC that's been inspired by Russian trickery.
This is how Putin is using Trump to destroy Ukraine and actually to put Europeans in biggest threat, because Russia, China and all these tyrannies, they will not stop.
And the Mayor of London has criticised Nigel Farage for dismissing allegations of racism against him as banter. The Reform UK leader has been facing claims relating to his time at Dulwich College. Mr Farage has previously said he categorically did not racially abuse fellow pupils. LBC weather, heavy rain across the north and the west of England and Wales as well overnight, becoming clearer and less windy. For Northern Ireland and the northwest of the UK, dry in the southeast with a low of around 7 degrees. From Global Newsroom. For LBC, I'm Tim Daly.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Nick Abbott.
So as you know, a festival for Hanukkah advertised as a night of family fun was taking place with children attending the event when two men stepped out of a vehicle at Bondi Beach and started opening fire. Diane Coveney-Garland is news director at 2SM Radio based in Sydney, and she joins us on the line now. Hello, Diane.
Hello, Nick. How are you?
Good, thanks. What do we know about the people who did this?
Well, it was a 50-year-old father and his 24-year-old son. They live in the southwestern suburb of Sydney in Bonnyrigg. Apparently, they were staying in Campsie, which is closer into the city, and there are suggestions they were staying at an Airbnb, so police raided that property overnight as well. The 50-year-old father was shot dead by police and his son was critically injured but is in a critical but stable condition under police guard in hospital at the moment. Now, the key information here is that the older man, the father, had 6 firearms legally licensed in his name. Now, we did ask at a press conference with the police commissioner, the prime minister and the premier this morning, how is it that somebody who did something like this could legally have firearms in his name? And the police commissioner said that will form part of the investigation. Now, he had 6 and police were initially concerned because there were so many shots fired and so many weapons that there may have been a third person involved. However, they now have ruled out any other person being involved in the specific shooting at Bondi Beach, but investigations will continue. And as I mentioned, they have actually raided the home in Bonnyrigg and the property in Campsie as well. But the police commissioner is confident that there were only the father and the son who were involved. And the latest that we have heard is that 15 people were killed. The 16th person who died was the 50-year-old man who was one of the shooters. Those killed range in age from a 10-year-old girl through to an 87-year-old. So it's quite a number of people who lost their lives in this horrific incident.
An improvised explosive device was found, we heard, and it looked like they were using military assault weapons. Does that imply that they had military training?
Well, that's an interesting question. I'm not really sure about that, but the improvised explosive device, police actually did say that they were very basic devices. Somebody did ask whether they were possibly able to be detonated using a mobile phone or a switch or a button or something, and police said no, they actually had a wick on them, but they were ready to be detonated, but they didn't explode, which is really good because, unfortunately, if that did happen, the death toll would have been a lot higher. We're not actually sure whether they had military training. I think the younger man, the 24-year-old, he was a bricklayer and had recently lost his job, and I'm not sure about the father's, what sort of work he was involved in.
Australia famously suffered the biggest mass shooting in 1996 in Port Arthur. That left 35 dead in Tasmania. And since then, there was a toughening up of gun laws in Australia, which specifically restricted semi-automatic gun sales. Yet that's what it looked like they were using. Is that kind of weapon, readily available in Australia as it is in America?
No, it's not. That's the unusual thing, because police said that the 6 firearms that were used were legally obtained and were licensed to the 50-year-old man. They did look like, as you say, like sort of military weapons. However, he was allowed to have them legally. And the New South Wales Premier, Chris Minns, has said that he will be cracking down on weapons in New South Wales, along the same lines as what John Howard did back when Port Arthur happened. And unfortunately, a lot of the weapons that when we have drug or gang incidents in Australia, a lot of those weapons are actually printed on 3D printers. But police were very specific in saying that these firearms were legal because he had them licensed to his name. And you have to go through quite a bit of rigmarole to get a firearms license in New South Wales. You have to be able to prove that you don't have any sort of mental illness or any other sort of issues like that. You need to be able to prove what you're going to use those weapons for. However, the police commissioner, Mel Lennon, wouldn't be drawn on how it is that this man was able to have 6 firearms legally in his possession with license for all of them. So that's going to form a key part of the investigation as well.
You mentioned New South Wales a couple of times. Is it true that there are different gun stipulations and regulations depending on which state you're in?
There probably are, but they're all fairly strict as far as I know. So they might be slightly minor changes. We did have a really shocking shooting in a place in called Wiambilla in Queensland a couple of years back, where three police officers were killed and three civilians were killed when police returned fire. And I know in Queensland they have cracked down as well. But the actual gun legislation is really tough Australia-wide in the wake of what happened at Port Arthur.
And yet, after Port Arthur in 96, there was a gun amnesty declared and gun ownership plummeted. But now there's over 4 million guns in Australia, which is double that of 2001. What do you put that down to?
Well, I don't know. I know, look, obviously farmers use weapons on, you know, weapons for livestock and that sort of thing, and killing feral animals and things like that. But as far as, honestly, I don't know why somebody who lives in Sydney's southwest would be able to or would want to have six firearms licensed in their name, and the number of weapons that has doubled. I mean, maybe it is the case that people are getting a little bit more interested in taking up. I mean, I don't know that you'd use a firearm in any sort of sport or anything like that. That'd be more of a pistol if you were doing like the clay target shooting, that sort of thing. So I really don't know how it is and why it is. And particularly living in the city, if you were living in a country area or on the outskirts in some of the more rural areas on the outskirts of Sydney, I can understand why you may want or need a firearm, but not living in the southwestern suburbs.
Mm. One of the men who has been named as the perpetrator was on a terror watch list, apparently. There's obviously going to be questions about how, being on that list, he was able to do this. But how difficult really is it to monitor people on a list closely enough to prevent something like this?
Well, look, police said that the man who was on there, they were aware of him, but there wasn't anything much to that. But, I mean, that's police speak for we're not going to tell you exactly what we know. And I know that the police commissioner was very guarded with all of the questions asked. There were a lot of questions about has the government failed, have police failed, have emergency services failed, because, you know, this is a huge death toll. This is going to change Australia as we know it. And It just seems like police, I wouldn't suggest they're being cagey, but they're just keeping their cards close to their chest until they get more information. But it's just, you just needed to look at the Prime Minister or the Premier this morning. They just look downtrodden, downcast, and, you know, I guess a lot of people haven't had sleep in the wake of what happened last night. But, you know, to have the Premier and the Prime Minister just standing there looking shattered, it's not a good look.
And what do we know about the man who fought with and disarmed one of the shooters?
Oh, incredible. He's a fruit shop owner, a 43-year-old from, his name's Ahmed. He just took it upon himself. He'd just gone to Bondi Beach for the day. He saw what was going on and just took it upon himself to crash tackle one of the gunmen. And he did so and managed to get the weapon away from him. But then after that, he was shot twice and was rushed to hospital to undergo surgery. However, a lot of people, you know, the Prime Minister, the Premier, the police, he's been labelled a hero. And I would imagine that once he's out of surgery, he'd be getting some sort of bravery medal or something like that, because he really did. Police said if it wasn't for people like that, the toll could have been a whole lot higher.
Diane, thanks very much for your time. That's Diane Coveney-Garland, News Director at 2SM Radio based in Sydney. Lord John Walney is an independent peer and former advisor on political violence and disruption to the UK government, and he joins us on the line now. Good evening, Lord Walney.
Good evening.
This sort of thing couldn't happen here, could it, because of our more strict gun laws, am I right?
Well, we are fortunate to have relatively strict gun laws, but I would just ask you to take a breath and reflect on that last interview where you spent 10 minutes talking about a great deal of detail about the method of attack, and nothing about the people who had been attacked and the motivation. And the reason I think that is really important to point out is that this is coming as part of an explosion of anti-Semitism since the 7th of October. And you say, well, this couldn't happen in this country, that the Jewish community in Britain is still reeling from the murders at the Manchester, the Heaton Park Synagogue, where, yes, you could say, well, we are relatively fortunate that it was a knife rather than a gun. But either way, it is Jewish people who are living in fear and are being targeted, and are, you notice that you had the defiance of coming outside to mark Hanukkah, this evening, which had to be done in Manchester and in London with a heavy police presence, because Jews do not feel safe in this country, very understandably. And I think we should spend a bit more time on that and not take up the whole of this program talking about gun laws.
Okay, point taken, but it's a bit difficult to say with certainty what somebody's motive was for a crime before they've been interviewed.
No, indeed, but it is absolutely, or it's essential that we look at this as an attack on a group of people gathered, a group of Jewish people gathered to celebrate Hanukkah, as an anti-Semitic attack. And it is absolutely reasonable to look at what is happening, what has just happened, the horror of what has just happened on Bondi Beach. You look at what's happened in Manchester. You look at Jews being shot dead, Israelis being shot dead in Washington, D.C. You look at attacks in Canada. All over the West, there is this huge rise in anti-Semitism, which is not simply being felt by Jewish people as intimidation and fear. Jewish people are losing their lives. We are entering, I'm afraid to say, a deeply dark period in our history. And it is vital that we understand what is happening, and address it rather than going round and round the houses without actually identifying what is happening here.
Okay, well, let's address it. What do you put this rise of anti-Semitism down to?
Well, you are right. You're absolutely right that we do not yet know the motivation of today. But overall, I think what you've seen in the last 2 years is this explosion after, in the wake of 7th of October. And yes, I think as Rachel Mazel was talking, was saying in your initial package, there are some who want to try in a disgusting way to make that in some way linked to the actions of the Israeli state. What is actually happening is the opposite. The anti-Semitic violence on the 7th of October 2023, and let's remind ourselves what that was. That was the mass slaughter of civilians. That was the rape, the beheading, the burning alive of Israelis, of Jewish people, because they were Jews. That actually has emboldened a level of anti-Semitism that is being felt in every corner of the world where Jewish people live. And
you think it was that specific day that has given rise to the anti-Semitism that you've described?
Well,
rather than what followed.
Oh no, absolutely, absolutely. Because you look at the biggest spike in anti-Semitism came actually on the 7th and 8th of October, before there was any response from the Israeli state at all.
What do you mean by that? The biggest rise in anti-Semitism measured by what metric?
Oh, well, the Community Security Trust, which is the body who is funded by the Jewish community and by the government in the UK to try to keep Jewish people safe. But what they also do is they monitor the number of anti-Semitic incidents. And you saw the biggest spike on the 7th and the 8th of October, because people were seeing that and they were celebrating and they were emboldened. And they thought it was then okay to do what they would have been otherwise more reticent to do, which was to go out and to abuse Jewish people. Now, we're not talking about this having appeared after the 7th of October, since the 7th of October. Of course, this is an ancient hatred. This has been literally going on in Jewish people have been targeted for literally hundreds and thousands.
It's as old as thousands of years. It's as old as racism itself, yeah. Of course.
Mm. No, absolutely. But you have seen this huge rise since the 7th of October. And even if you were not prepared to accept those figures that analysis, that it spiked before there was any response from Israel, which would be going in flying in the face of the figures if you were disputing that. But then you move beyond that to say, well, even if you thought that actually in some way Israel was to blame, disgusting though that view is, on what grounds would you then turn up outside a synagogue in Manchester and try to kill Jews who were marking Yom Kippur? And on what grounds would you go and let us, if it turns out that is indeed what it looks like, would you go and turn up on Bondi Beach with semi-automatic weapons to try to kill Jews?
Yeah, it's difficult to try to fathom some logic, because mental illness might play a large part in everything that we've just been discussing. Lord Walney, I'm going to have to leave it there just because of time. Thank you for that. Lord Walney is an independent peer, former advisor on political violence and disruption to the UK government. What do you make of what you've heard this evening? 0345 6060 973.
LBC.
At Vodafone, you can save up to £1,032 with the Samsung Galaxy S25 FE when you trade in an eligible phone. And keep you and your family connected this Christmas. Hurry! Offer ends the 17th of December. So, go online or in-store today. Vodafone.
Save £576 on 5GB airtime over 36 months. £144 on phone and £312 with trade-in. Phone cost is £534. Credit and trade-in checks and terms apply. Financed by Vodafone.
Waitrose presents... And the main event. One cook learns that love doesn't always shout.
Ain't that for me?
Sometimes it whispers.
I saved you best bit, Dad.
Starring succulent number one free-range turkey bauble wrapped in dried cured beetroot smoked bacon. With cranberry jeweled pork stuffing and orange glaze.
Ooh, thanks.
Waitrose, the home of food lovers. Subject to availability and delivery slots, available to order online and in stores from 19th of December.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
Yes, so we're talking about the shooting at Bondi Beach. In a short while, there was another shooting that preceded it. That was in America at Brown University. Are we crossing to America to hear the latest from there about that? But what are your thoughts on what you've heard so far? 0345 6060 973. Greenford, Aziz.
Hello, thanks for taking my call.
Hiya.
I was quite surprised by your independent... advisor, etc., Lord Walney, because I think he couldn't be further from the truth. I think there is, I think with all these cases, with all these shootings, etc., like the attack in Manchester, and this, I think there's definitely a case of some form of mental illness involved. And I think it's definitely spurred on by a sense of injustice. But it's all linked together. The war crimes being committed in Gaza, etc., it's all linked. That's what's really fueling the whole rise in anti-Semitism. Anti-Semitism is a very, very nasty thing. But I think it's being watered down by every single criticism you have of Israel being claimed to be anti-Semitic.
Hang on a minute. What do you mean by watered down? I don't understand what that means.
Well, what I mean, it's almost like the boy who cries wolf, where the real cases, the horrible cases of anti-Semitism that are taking place, get drowned up when you hear every single time somebody criticises the Israeli government, there's a chant of anti-Semitism coming back.
Right. So, yeah.
And I think...
To be clear, what you're saying is it is not anti-Semitic to criticise the Israeli government.
Absolutely. And I think the Israeli community, the Jewish community itself, is not homogenous. You can see Jewish community members on the marches on the Gaza protests. Hmm. New York, the city with the largest concentration of Jewish people outside Israel itself, a third of those Jewish people voted for Mandani, who's very anti-Israel. So it's your former advisor talking about how Jewish people, they're reacting in shock at the killings, but the whole world is reacting in shock at the killings.
Yeah, I'm not sure Mamdani was anti-Israel. You may know more about him than I do, but I'm not sure that's entirely true. What Lord Wanley was exercised about was my concentration on the how easy it is to get these kind of weapons in Australia. I was asking those questions because Australia is a relative stranger to this kind of thing compared to America. In America, they have a mass shooting, which is described as four or more people being shot at the same time in the same incident, every single day. The reason you don't hear much about them is because the news cycle does not really accept stories that are just the same thing over and over and over again. So only the most newsworthy of them get to reach us, or even the American public. They also have a mass school shooting every week. And that is, I would suggest, specifically because Americans are allowed to buy any kind of weaponry they like with almost no checks of any kind on what kind of person it is that is buying them. Now, Australia, they had that incident that we talked about earlier at Port Arthur in 1996, where 35 people were killed, and that was in Tasmania. And since then, they toughened up the gun laws. But there seems to have been something that happened to Australia. And I wonder if it's partly because the gun lobby and its political donations, which have been so successful in neutering any gun laws in America, may have been at work in Australia as well. In fact, I know that that is true. So, you know, the reason that countries like this don't have mass shootings like this is because people find it very difficult, if not impossible, to get these kind of weapons. You can't have a mass shooting if you don't have something that approaches a military assault rifle, which is what it looked like these people were using. Cannock, hello, Brian.
Hi, Nick. How are you doing?
Good, thanks.
Basically, I was pretty incensed by Lord Walney, but generally I am. Can I just state a few...
Incensed in what way? About what?
About pretty much everything he was saying. Right. I mean, basically, I think that... can I give you a couple of starting points? First of all, I am Jewish, right? And I lost family in the Holocaust, right? I am deeply opposed to what is going on in Israel against Gaza. And I feel that people like Lord Walney, they are exploiting the awful, awful events that happened in Australia and also in Manchester to try and whitewash the Israeli Zionist position.
Well, right? I'm your knowledge of Lord Walney may exceed mine, but that's certainly not what I got from the conversation that I just had with him.
Well, I feel like he did not want to talk about the broader issue. All he was concerned about was conflating. Suggesting that all Jewish people have the same view, which we most certainly do not. And I feel like he constantly just promotes the same very pro-Zionist opinion. There are an awful lot of Jewish people in this country who take a very different view. We're very dedicated to the Jewish faith and very opposed to Zionism and the Israeli state.
Have you personally noticed an increase in feelings of anti-Semitism?
No, I haven't. Not personally. Right, I'm not denying that that is happening to some people, but I haven't. And I am very aware of the large Jewish bloc that has marched with Palestinian supporters every Saturday for months, including... survivors from Auschwitz.
But in some people's minds, to interrupt, but in some people's minds, the Jewish community is synonymous with the Israeli government. But that is not true, is it?
And that is exactly the point. The Israeli government and the pro-Zionist movement have worked incredibly hard to conflate Judaism with Zionism. And the consequence is that there are an awful lot of twisted people who think that basically if you're Jewish, then you're pro-Israel and you're pro-Zionism. And I think that actually promotes anti-Semitism rather than tackles the awful poison that anti-Semitism actually is.
Yes, and if people are infected with that poison and they have some sort of mental imbalance, then they, at the very least, should be restricted from buying weapons of mass destruction, which these military assault rifles actually are. And in America, they can get them quite easily. And in Australia, it appears that that is also true, despite the crackdown after the Port Arthur massacre on gun ownership in Australia, which seems to have gone into reverse in recent years. And I suspect it's because of that gun lobby that I was talking about. Thanks for that, Brian. More of your calls on this to come. Another shooting has taken place, this one at Brown University in America. We'll have the latest details on that after these news headlines with Tim Daly.
Police investigating the Bondi Beach terror attack on a Jewish celebration in Australia say the perpetrators were a father and son. The 50-year-old was shot dead. His 24-year-old accomplice is under guard in hospital after 15 others were killed. The Home Office is saying more than 700 migrants arrived in the UK from France on Saturday. They made the journey using 11 boats. And it's being reported NATO's president has dropped his push for Kyiv to join NATO. Volodymyr Zelensky made the announcement while travelling to meetings with the Trump administration. LBC weather, heavy rain for the north and the west of England and also Wales overnight. Clearer and less windy in Northern Ireland and the northwest of the UK. Dry in the southeast with a low of 7 degrees.
This is LBC.
There's an old Thai saying that roughly translates as, the family who takes the internet on holiday can locate a less crowded beach. Particularly handy, my friend, if it's peak mating season for nippy little crabs. Pack the internet with an eSIM from Aerolo. That's A-I-R-A-L-O.
They did it again. Flour instead of flowers. On my birthday. I'm 95 minutes late, but it's hard to leave when you've shared so much. Your postcode, your gluten intolerance. Then I saw it. 25% off your first Ocado shop, plus free delivery. And I just knew I'd found the online supermarket of my dreams. Ocado, life delivered. Geographical restrictions. Min spend £60. Max saving £20. Charges and Christmas restrictions apply. New customers only. Terms at Ocado.com.
40 million people listen to commercial radio each week. That's 80 million ears. Give or take. Amplify your advertising at RadioCentre.org.
The Big Tasty is back at McDonald's. But now, it's a double. It's the beefiest Big Tasty of all time ever. Oh, got a bit intense there. The new Double Big Tasty. Now at McDonald's. Available until the 4th of Jan 2026 from 11 a.m. Price and participation may vary, subject to availability.
This is LBC with Nick Abbott. Call 0345 6060973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
Bondi Beach was not the only place there was a mass shooting yesterday. People have been killed and critically injured at a shooting at Brown University, which is in Providence, Rhode Island. John Doman is a reporter and presenter for WTOP News in Washington and joins us on the line. Hello, John.
Hey, how's it going tonight?
Pretty good, thanks. What do we know about the shooter in this case?
So the Washington Post is reporting that it's a 24-year-old man from the state of Wisconsin, which is about halfway across the country. But another interesting aspect about this guy, a former military guy as well, is he may have also lived in the Washington, D.C. area shortly before or, you know, at least sometime recently. What his connection was to that school in Rhode Island is still unknown. I mean, you're talking about a school that is a good you know, 8 to 9 hour drive maybe from, you know, I guess, especially with traffic, from here in the D.C. area up to there and even further from Wisconsin. So there's still a lot that authorities just haven't said about what happened there yet this weekend.
Well, what do we know about his military career?
That he spent 3 years, never saw any combat, was I guess considered an infantryman or whatever. But, you know, 3 years in the military, never saw combat. He's 24 years old. This is all just from the Washington Post. He has not been publicly identified at this point. The authorities in Rhode Island saying that they weren't going to do that until charges were filed. That could happen either later this evening or tomorrow morning.
And the shooting happened apparently inside a classroom. Is somewhere like Brown University an easy place to get into if you don't have a valid reason for being there?
So a lot of college buildings, and I can't speak to Brown because I've never been there, but a lot of college buildings in general, at least around here, a lot of them have access cards that you need to get into now. And now during normal daytime hours, you don't always have to be able to do that. A lot of public buildings, classrooms, that sort of thing, you can usually just sort of get in without needing any special access. The fact that they were on the weekend and that they were studying for some final exams, you know, you wonder if those were open to anybody. But even still, with so much activity happening, sometimes somebody just hold the door open for you. You know, you're trying to be polite. That's one of those things. You know, they're usually more secure when it comes to the dormitories and the residence halls where people stay in. Then they're very strict about who gets let in. But classroom buildings, that sort of thing, typically not as difficult during a normal day.
Is Brown University the kind of place that would have armed security?
I mean, they might have, you know, a small police force or something like that, but you're not going to see security guards posted up in every building, especially on a weekend. I mean, this was a class where it wasn't even a full class. It was one of those study sessions that they were doing before finals that, you know, maybe a fraction of the class showed up for. But the fact that it was just sort of an open building, you're not going to usually have armed security there, no.
Initially, the police said that they detained a person of interest. That was their phrase. And then they say they hadn't. What happened there?
So they get really strange about some of the terminology. It's one thing I've noticed, law enforcement in general around here tends to be very hesitant to call somebody a suspect or ascribe even more. It's almost one of those things where it just seems like they were trying to be very reluctant. They found this guy at a hotel, I think it was about 20 miles away from the scene of the shooting. You know, why he had a room that far. Like, it's all, again, just such a big mystery. The fact that they have not said about the suspect, about the motive. The most that we've gotten is that, you know, he barged into that classroom and yelled something that, you know, I guess some of the students there couldn't quite make out. They couldn't quite understand what he was saying. Beyond that, again, you know, they're just not sharing a lot of information at this point. You know, one of the things I've found, you know, reporting around here, especially when it comes to big crimes, a lot of times you have to wait until that person shows up in a courtroom making an initial appearance. Then you start to get a lot more information because that's when prosecutors have to start, I guess, releasing some of their evidence to the judge. And then you can kind of pick up on stuff. In a public setting around here these days, it's harder and harder to get a lot of information. Law enforcement tends to be very reluctant to either reveal too much or do something they think might damage their case later on.
Brown University was one of the universities that Trump picked out for special attention, one of the Ivy League universities that he didn't think was operating in the way that best pleased him. And Brown, they initially caved on some things, but I think they stood up to him on their curriculum and the people that they would enroll. Have universities like Brown that did not cave to Trump been subject to aggression and threats against them since that happened?
Since it happened, no. I mean, what we saw at universities around here a lot in the last year or so tended to do more with protests between pro-Palestinian supporters and those who felt that schools were either, you know, not doing enough to support the Palestinian cause, or on the flip side, not doing enough to support Jewish students who might have been facing some aggression from Palestinian students, or just, you know, felt that they were being intimidated in general. But I think at this point, it would be speculative to say that whatever this guy was doing, that it had anything to do with what President Trump had to say, because we just don't know at this point.
This kind of incident is, forgive me, but it's wearyingly common in America, isn't it? There's a mass school shooting about once a week, and there's a mass shooting of some sort or other about once a day. And yet, nothing seems to be done about it. The Republican Party specifically will just say, well, it's too early to talk about gun control, and offer their thoughts and prayers. Is that it?
That is a common critique of the Republican Party right now when it comes to this particular issue. It has been generally, as you described, that's generally been their response to a lot of these incidents for several years now. And, you know, every school around the country now, elementary schools, I mean, even preschools at this point, you know, they do drills and training just for this sort of worst case scenario. And some of the students who were involved or who were there over the weekend and saw what happened, you know, they relied on that training that they've been getting for a long time now. And, you know, I saw a story. One of them even had been shot in one of those shootings in high school and specifically went all the way across the country to a state like Rhode Island because they thought that they would have a lower likelihood of being involved in something like this. And ended up getting shot anyway in it. It's one of those things where it sort of transcends state borders here, whether it's a state that has very strict gun control or one that does not. And, you know, you mentioned sort of the common critique of the Republican Party and that sort of has not moved them off of that position, no matter how much pressure they get from certain people, because there is also a strong base of support that does not tolerate any sort of restriction that they feel might be placed on their access to firearms right now.
It seems extraordinary. I mean, what you just described is schools in this country have fire drills. Schools in America have active shooter drills.
Yeah, we have both. It's one of those things where with my own kids, I don't really, you know, we get the warning that, hey, we're going to be doing this, and they know that they have to do certain things. I don't know if it's once a month or once a quarter or a semester or something, but yeah, that's kind of where we are at this point.
And does Brown University just carry on? Are they closed down or are they reopened for business?
So they are canceling all their final exams, all the rest of their, you know, I guess end of the semester activities. At this point, students are allowed to pack their stuff up and go home for the rest of the winter break. They were about to start final exams over the next few days and then, you know, have probably a 3 or 4 week long Christmas break. They are going to be gone until sort of mid-January, I guess, at this point.
Good to talk to you, John. Thanks very much for your time. That's John Doman, reporter and presenter for WTOP News in Washington, D.C. A little later on in the program, we'll be crossing to our regular correspondent from Washington, Simon Marks, his take on this and other events that have happened in America over the past week. That'll be in the last hour just before the 1 o'clock news. At the moment, we're going to take a short break and then come back with more of your thoughts on both this shooting and the one that happened in Bondi Beach. This is LBC.
LBC. This week on Nick Ferrari at Breakfast.
Chris, you're through to the Commissioner.
Just curious to think if you believe Donald Trump was right to criticize Vicon.
He said that he was a nasty person. He also talked about the crime that engulfs London. Commissioner.
There's no no-go areas. That's completely false. I think how anybody in America can suggest the UK is violent is completely ridiculous.
Plus, a cry from the heart from Health Secretary Wes Streeting to doctors poised to strike.
We've made a lot of progress together, not just on pay and on jobs, but on the NHS itself. Don't put that recovery at risk.
A New Year's resolution.
Let's try and start 2026 with a fresh start. We could all do without this war of words.
Nick Ferrari at Breakfast. Back tomorrow morning from 7. Listen on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app.
This Christmas at Tesco, get selected meat joints and boneless salmon sides better than half price with your Tesco Club card. That's what makes it Christmas. Tesco, every little helps. Majority of larger stores excludes Northern Ireland. Beef and lamb ends 28th of the 12th. Hawk, 6th of the 1st. Gammon, 13th of the 1st. Salmon, 1st of the 1st. Club card required.
This festive season at McDonald's, get
rich deals every day.
Okay, okay.
With a sausage sandwich for just,
let's see, 9 and MP.
Six chicken McNuggets for just
9 and MP.
Fine. Get Grinch deals every day
in the McDonald's app.
18 plus app only. Ends 24th of December. One use per offer. Fees apply to delivery. Participation varies. T's and C's apply.
At Fidelity, we've been helping our customers plan for their retirements for nearly 20 years. From understanding how much you'll need to combining multiple pensions, we offer expert insights, excellent service, and even financial advice, so you can feel confidently invested in your future. For pensions, advice, or investment accounts, be invested with Fidelity. Go to fidelity.co.uk. Your capital is at risk. Transferring is not right for everyone. Terms apply.
At Lidl, get the best value this Christmas when you're carving up a storm. We won't be beaten on price with our Birchwood fresh British whole turkeys in store from the 19th of December. Now that's what we call a showstopper. Lidl, more to value.
Selected products price match in most major UK supermarkets until 24th of the 12th. See lidl.co.uk/LPTV. While stocks last, exclusions apply.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
Yes, that's the phone number, 0345 6060 973. You can also text 84850. You can email nicka@lbc.co.uk. And if you are on WhatsApp, it's the same number as the phone, 0345 6060 973. We're talking about the terrible events at Bondi Beach and at Brown University. And this is a call from Australia in Queensland, James. Hello, James.
Hello, Nick. I just wanted to clear a couple of things up, just for misinformation reasons, that's all. We've got possibly the strictest gun laws in the world here. And you keep saying military assault rifle. They weren't. They appear to have been shotguns with heavy gauge shot.
I'm no gun expert, but it didn't look like shotgun to me. But anyway. There's over 4 million guns in Australia. It's double that since 2001. That doesn't sound like they're very restricted.
Oh, they are very restricted. You have to go through hoops. You cannot legally own an assault rifle. And these guns that these guys had were legally owned with a license. So
right,
they were shotguns.
But 4 million guns doesn't sound like it's difficult to get one.
Well, I mean, it's for people that do skeet shooting and that kind of thing. That's basically the rifles that were used. Well, they weren't rifles, they were shotguns. So, I mean, all I wanted to say was, you know what it's like with the truth getting its pants down before it's gone around the end of the world. It's kind of, I just thought I really ought to mention that, just for the correct information, that's all.
Well, yeah.
Nobody owns military assault rifles legally in this country.
Right, but there's only 25 million people in Australia, and if they've got 4 million guns, that suggests that a significant population. Either a few people have a lot of guns, or there's a lot of people who have a few guns. Which is it?
It's the few people having a lot, basically.
And am I right in thinking that the gun lobby, the same gun lobby that makes America's gun laws so lax, has had, or they have boasted about having success in the fight against Australia's gun laws, and they've called for action against limiting the number of guns Australians can own. They've even had action against mental health checks for gun licenses. I mean, can you make any sense of that?
Well, I don't know how true that is, to be honest, because gun lobbies in America will not influence the law over here, that's for sure. Since Port Arthur, they absolutely clamped down on background checks, mental health checks, medical checks, your internet checks, everything.
That is not my understanding. My understanding is that those checks initially came in and then they have been exercised quite loosely and differently depending on which state you're in.
Well, no, I think it's more of a federal thing, you'll find. I think the other thing as well I'd like to mention, Nick, is that what does concern me more than anything is there is a rumour, and that's all it is at this stage, that this guy was on some kind of watch list. Now, that is a big worry. So I don't know how true that is. I mean, obviously, I've been getting the news here as it's happening because I'm here.
Mm. But, yeah, my understanding is that he was on some sort of terrorist watch list, or not necessarily a terrorist watch list, but some sort of a watch list of some sort that he was known to the authorities.
And that makes it absolutely staggering that he had actually any firearms certificates or licenses.
It would be a surprise. Yeah. Okay. Thanks, James. 0345 6060 973. Carla texts, the government should hold their heads in shame. Disgraceful. The Jewish community has not been protected. Schools, universities, restaurants, these poor people have to endure abuse on a daily basis. It's difficult to know what a government in Australia, I mean, because that's what we're talking about, or less so America, because they could actually do something about the gun laws, but they just refuse to. But it's difficult to know what the Australian government could do to prevent something like this. I mean, if people want the freedom to, you know, go about their daily business, the freedom to work and play, then how can you, with 100% certainty, protect everybody all the time? Glasgow. Hello, Eric.
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 Oh, God, it's so simple. The only people that should be allowed guns, rifles, anything that's going to hurt another human being is the police, the army, the military, rather, and a farmer. Right? That's it. That's all you need for people to carry weapons like this.
The farmer part is difficult to police, though, isn't it? Because people could say, well, I'm kind of a farmer. I've got a big yard and I have to shoot, in Australia, possums or whatever it is that is a pest. I've got no idea.
People would say that the farmer is out of the gun because they're pro fox, you know, they're like animals and all that. That's a different debate, okay? However, it's something to consider. Now, I was in Texas last year, the first time I ever been to the United States of America.
Mm.
Oh, my God. Everybody, I had a pal, right? It was an American Army for a wee while. He's got an arsenal in his house.
Yes, people in America do tend to, there are people in America who do tend to collect guns. Not everybody in America has got a gun, but a lot of people in America have a lot of guns.
Different states have different laws, but Texas is one of these states where people were walking about with John Wayne over there.
Yeah.
Right? And the only thing that I didn't see some doing was a tank. That's the way to see some of the things that these people have got. I'm telling you, the sniper. There's all sorts of weapons over there.
Yeah, I've seen it myself. You go to at least the last time I went, you can go into a supermarket and literally next to the frozen peas aisle, there will be a selection of guns for you to peruse.
Yeah, just before I go, right? But see the are people scared? Is that why they want a gun? I'm trying to figure out why people, because of what's happening in the world and how things are going. So you said that Australia's doubling
since 2001, apparently, there are double the number of guns in Australia than before. Yeah.
Well, why don't we find that out? Why doesn't certainly not me, I'm not that clever, but maybe some of these politicians are clever enough to find why this is happening.
Well, that is the question. Thank you, Eric. 0345-6060-973. This text says, I am an Orthodox Jew who was raised in Stamford Hill. A large section of Orthodox Jews fundamentally oppose Zionism on religious grounds, but unfortunately they are the most visibly Jewish and often bear the brunt of anti-Israel sentiments. I personally think that Zionism has been successful in making anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism synonymous to the detriment of all Jews. So what do you make of what you have heard so far? And are you comforted by the fact that it is much more difficult than certainly in America and apparently Australia to buy these weapons that really shouldn't have any place other than in a field of war? Farah says, unfortunately, schools in England also have active shooter drills. Do you have experience of that? I've never heard of that. Schools in England have active shooter drills. Is that true? He says, my children have been practicing hiding under tables since they were in primary school. That doesn't sound right. Does anybody have any experience of that? 0345-6060-973. Schools in England have active shooter drills. That seems unlikely. Laura texts, we have a terrorist attack training and drills in this in this country in regular state schools. When I first did it about 16 years ago, I found it highly disturbing, and they said things like, stay still, even if you're injured, because we need to find the perpetrator first, and if you move, we might think it's you. Horrifying times. Well, if that is true, then I stand corrected. I'm really quite surprised. But what we know so far is that 15 people in Australia, Bondi Beach, including children, are dead after two gunmen who were apparently related. They were father and son, so we heard. And they were armed with rifles, that's what they are described as, not shotguns. And they opened fire at a festival for Hanukkah, which was advertised as a night of family fun. That was taking place for children attending the event. And then two men stepped out of a vehicle at the beach and started opening fire from the position of an elevated bridge there. Injured count is about 29, as far as I know. One of the shooters is dead and the other is in hospital, who will be interviewed by the police as soon as they can make that happen, I would imagine. Pennsylvania. Hello, Lou.
Hello there. I just wanted to call and say I was quite surprised at how naive James was to suggest that the gun lobby wouldn't be active in Australia. There is evidence from all over the world that the gun lobby from America has been active in different countries. So although I don't know for certain, I would find it completely plausible they would be active in Australia. But it's not about a love of guns or a passion of guns. It's about business and cash. We know from economic data you can find online that American gun manufacturers profited, I think it was about over $850,000 in 2023 from selling guns in Australia. So it's big money. So of course, you know, where there's money, there's lobbyists.
Yes, and the gun lobby in America is protecting and promoting the manufacturers of guns in America. But of course, they're the same manufacturers that sell guns all over the world.
Absolutely. So it's in their interest to lobby in foreign nations to ensure that the gun laws are as slack as possible so they can sell more guns.
Yes, they've even sort of celebrated the gun lobby in Australia. They've celebrated their work in action against limiting the number of guns that Australians can own and against mental health checks for gun licenses, which sounds exactly like what's happened in America.
Yes, it's very similar to here, unfortunately. But the mentality here around guns is something I will never comprehend. The belief of the need for them, the belief of the right for them, the belief of the necessity is just frankly astonishing in a modern country.
And what is interesting is that when a Democrat is elected president, gun sales go through the roof because people have been persuaded that a Democratic president is going to take their guns away. And so it's like they preload.
Yeah, and they disaster pack along with the fact that they acquire guns because they think that civil war is coming. It's quite an extraordinary mentality.
The preppers. Yeah, I've been around them in Oregon, and they're unique and special bunch. Lou, thanks for that. Appreciate the call. 0345-6060-973. Boreham Wood. Hello, Darren.
Yeah, hi, Nick. Nice to talk to you. Long-time listener.
Oh, thanks.
That's all right. My daughter goes to a Jewish school, so does my son, and primary, secondary, and every 6 weeks they have active shooter drills where they have to hide under the desks.
Really?
And have to improvise possible people coming into the school. So, yes, it does happen. It happens on a regular basis. It happens all over the UK.
I had no idea. That is appalling.
Absolutely. And this is what we have to live under. And this is where we are at the moment.
Yes. I mean, I suppose we can be comforted by the knowledge that the guns are much less frequently owned in this country. I mean, we just don't have the kind of preponderance of guns that they do in the States.
You're absolutely right. There's plenty of kitchen knives.
Well, that's true, but it's a much more difficult task to kill a large number of people with a kitchen knife because they can run away, whereas if you run away from somebody with an assault rifle, then you can't run fast
enough.
Absolutely,
but you only have to kill one child. And also, there is a menorah lighting in Trafalgar Square. We were going to go, I think it's in a couple of days' time. We're not going to go because we're scared. And this is the UK as it is at the moment, and this is what's been festered and tolerated by lots of people, media included.
Right. Well, I'm not sure tolerated by the media is quite the right way of putting it, Darren, but I appreciate the call. Thanks for that. Elle from Northampton says they're called lockdown drills. A lot of people are responding with that. Yes, schools have drills, says Patrick. My son has to hide under the desk, drill, says Paul. Secondary teacher here, says Teresa. Yes, we do have drills, and kids get under the table. I had absolutely no idea. Astonishing. What a wonderful world, eh? Now, thanks for all your messages and calls on that subject. We're going to change it in the next hour. Reform UK has become Britain's largest party by membership, overtaking Labour after it shed 100,000 members since the general election. In the same poll, the Greens' Zach Polanski polls as the most popular party leader with voters. Will more members and more popularity translate to more voters? And does this signify growing dissatisfaction with Labour and the Tories? 0345 6060 973, Friday, Saturday, Sunday night at 10. Nick Abbott, LBC.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 11 o'clock. Police investigating the terror attack on Jewish people at Bondi Beach in Australia say they're not looking for anyone else over the killings. 15 people plus the shooter were shot dead, with the perpetrators being a father and son working together. The Australian journalist Diane Coveney-Garland has been telling Nick Abbott on LBC. One key question has now emerged.
The father had 6 firearms legally licensed in his name. We did ask a press conference with the police commissioner, the prime minister and the premier this morning. How is it that somebody who did something like this could legally have firearms? And the police commissioner said that will form part of the investigation.
The Australian prime minister says the country's Jewish community is hurting following the atrocity. The independent peer Lord Walney was a government advisor on political violence and disruption. He's been talking to LBC this evening.
This is coming as part of an explosion of anti-Semitism since the 7th of October. The Jewish community in Britain is still reeling from the Heaton Park synagogue. Either way, it is Jewish people who are living in fear and are being targeted.
The head of the UK's armed forces is due to warn the growing threats being faced by the country will require the whole nation to step up. Sir Richard Knighton will give a speech tomorrow. He says the general situation is the most dangerous he's ever seen in his career. US media is reporting a man being held over the Brown University shooting in Rhode Island has a military background with no previous criminal record. The authorities are now looking into possible links Benjamin Erickson may have had with the institution in Providence. The Washington-based reporter John Doman's been telling LBC an unofficial picture is emerging.
He spent 3 years in the military, never saw combat. He's 24 years old. This is all just from the Washington Post. He has not been publicly identified at this point. The authorities in Rhode Island saying that they weren't going to do that until charges were filed. That could happen either later this evening or tomorrow morning.
And the government says colleges will get £570 million as part of the drive to train more builders, coders and engineers. It's already promised to train 60,000 new construction workers to build homes by the end of the parliament. LBC weather, heavy rain across the north and the west of England and also Wales overnight, becoming clearer and less windy in Northern Ireland and the northwest of the UK, dry in the southeast with a low of around 7 degrees. From Global's newsroom, for LBC, I'm Tim Daly.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Nick Abbott.
A new poll has revealed that the Greens' Zach Polanski is currently the most popular party leader with voters. A survey found that Polanski has a net approval rating of -1, which doesn't sound bad, but it is considerably better than all of the other leaders. Let's talk about this with Joe Twyman. Joe is director of the polling agency Delta Poll and joins us on the line now. Hello, Joe.
Good evening.
It's interesting, isn't it? From nowhere, Zach Polanski has become the nation's most popular leader of a political party. How's he done that in 3 months?
Well, the answer is complicated and long-standing, so let's get straight down to it. I should be finished within about 3 hours. In summary, there is a growing feeling in this country of dissatisfaction, distrust and disapproval, not just of individual mainstream politicians or indeed the major political parties, but of the political class in general. And up until now, Nigel Farage and Reform UK have been very good at riding that wave of dissatisfaction and mopping up support from those on what was traditionally seen as the right of the political spectrum. Zach Polanski has emerged and has been able to attract attention and build support for the Greens on the left of the political spectrum, and so he's done a very good job of taking his skills and experience in the media, which is long standing, he's been around for a while, and turn that into actually cutting through to people. But as I say, I think this is more to do with dissatisfaction with the Conservatives and Labour particularly than it is to do with him specifically.
So Polanski was the favourite leader of a major political party in this poll, followed by the Liberal Democrat Ed Davey, followed by Kemi Badenoch, and then Nigel Farage. So given that Reform is still a one-man band as far as public recognition is concerned, how is it that Reform's leader is trailing in fourth, yet the party is polling first?
Well, these things are always complicated by the fact that individual performances are measured in absolute terms, whereas it's the relative performance that's important. And by that I mean that, yes, Zach Polanski may be doing okay in absolute terms. He may be at just below net zero, but in relative terms, he's not doing substantially better than any of the other party leaders, with the exception of Kemi Badenoch and particularly Keir Starmer. What Nigel Farage has going for him is the fact that while he has a large number of people opposing him, he also has a large number of people supporting him. They're very favourable towards him. Whereas particularly with someone like Ed Davey, the fact that he's close to net zero is more recognition of the fact that people don't have a view particularly strongly either way. And what Reform have been good at over the last 12 months really is turning that personal support that Nigel Farage has and really distilling it into poll ratings that have been favourable, and Reform have been ahead in every published poll since May of this year. But the question is, can they then turn that into votes in May next year when we come to the local elections across various parts of the country?
I mean, just to be clear, because net zero has connotations elsewhere, that by net zero you mean that the same number of people disapprove as approve. That would be net zero. And all of the political leaders are in the negative territory. It's just that Zach Polanski is closer to net zero than any of the others.
Yes, sorry, I do mean that strictly in polling terms, right, and not environmental policy terms. But it's worth pointing out that actually any kind of movement into net positive territory, so more people thinking you're doing a good job than a bad job, is relatively unusual for political leaders of any type at any time. And so you would hope to really get into that at your most popular moments, but you're never really looking for lasting support in the plus 20, plus 30 period. That's simply not realistic longer term because of the way that our adversarial political system works, and also the fact that political leaders are never that popular.
Now, the Prime Minister is the least popular of all. He polled last, and yet Labour are in second place in the same poll. What do you make of that?
Well, to say second place is it's a bit more complicated than that, I would say. Firstly, it's important not to look at individual polls, but at the long-term trends and what the polls show us collectively. That tells us a far more important story. And the story that we've seen really since Zach Polanski's election as Green leader is that Reform are ahead by some distance, and the degree of distance varies, but it's around about 10 points. They're fluctuating around the sort of high 20s, low 30s number. And then you have a second tier of parties, which in statistical terms, because of the margin of error associated with all polls, means that in a lot of cases, it's simply too close to call between not just Labour and Conservative and Lib Dem, but increasingly Greens as well. And then in certain areas of the country, when you throw in Plaid Cymru in Wales and the SNP in Scotland, you see a situation that, as I mentioned, come May, could get extremely complicated. And we could see five or perhaps even six parties battling it out on relatively even footing in certain areas. And that means that, that firstly, every vote counts, but also you're probably going to see a situation where individual candidates win on a relatively low share of the vote because the vote itself is split so many ways.
Do you think that Keir Starmer has had a fair crack of the whip? I mean, he took over after 14 years of Tory disasters and the effects of Brexit and the lingering effect of the 2007 financial crash and the pandemic. I mean, rarely has a Prime Minister been presented with such difficulties on entering number 10.
That's true, but if you were being critical of Keir Starmer, you would say that he hasn't done a very good job managing things since he came in, and the indications are that that certainly, in terms of how the public view these things, that the Labour Party didn't really have a plan for governing, only a plan for winning. And yes, they were successful at winning, but they haven't been particularly successful when it comes to actually getting their points and their feelings and their beliefs across. It's difficult for many in the public to identify exactly what this Labour Party stands for, other than things such as, oh, well, we're going to go for growth, but we don't have particular details on that. On the other side, if you're being supportive of Keir Starmer, you would say that people like Tony Blair and Alistair Campbell have talked about how in the early years of the first Blair administration in 1997, the Labour Party were too concerned about popularity and too concerned about what the front page of the newspaper said and what they said in focus groups. If you were being sympathetic to Keir Starmer, you'd say he's doing a very, very good job of not paying attention to public opinion. All of this, however, is should be taken in the context of the fact that there are 3.5 years until we have to call a general election.
Yes.
And so if you look back 3.5 years, that's when Boris Johnson was giving interviews about his plans for a third term. Mm. So an awful lot can happen in 3.5 years, and that could be good for Keir Starmer or it could be bad. But the point is that nobody knows exactly what it will be.
You know, Boris Johnson is gone, but he's not forgotten. Do you think his shadow sort of is looming large? It is part of the problem in this country that we have become addicted to drama and buffoonery since Boris Johnson's tenure. It's like politics is entertainment now and about identifying as a gang member or a cultist. And Starmer doesn't fit that.
Well, particularly when it comes to drama, I think you could go back further than Boris Johnson. I mean, really, the last 10 or more years have been characterised in British politics by these seismic events and huge drama that have moved the dial left, right, up, down in all sorts of directions. And I think there is a tendency for people now to associate with a particular side more in terms of the broad narratives or the vibes, as young people would say, more than sort of specific policy positions. Now, what that means for the long-term health of British politics remains to be seen. But I imagine we have much more drama ahead of us before things start to calm down.
Yeah, what role do you think the right-wing billionaire press barons have had in boosting Nigel Farage and hobbling Keir Starmer?
You could speculate on that in all sorts of directions. But what I would say is that this dissatisfaction, disapproval, and distrust that I've talked about was not created by Nigel Farage. Similarly, it wasn't created by Zach Polansky. These are long-standing concerns that a proportion of this country have, and they go back many years in cases. Sometimes for some people more than a few decades. And there is, if you look at it, actually good reason in some cases for people to feel dissatisfied. If you are, for instance, a young person, particularly a young male person who did not go to university, your chances of buying your own house have diminished significantly, not just in the last 5 or 10 years, but in the last 20 years. And the opportunities that you have nowadays are completely different from those of your parents. And that is simply one of a number of groups who feel a aggrieved and with some justification. Now, you can say these issues are complicated, and they certainly are, but actually solving them, along with so many of the massive questions that we face, not just in this country, but in developed democracies generally, whether it's about aging populations or the rise of AI or globalization, etc., etc., the answers to these questions are difficult, but no one within mainstream politics, at least so far, has provided something that the public themselves have been widely convinced by. We've had a lot of change projected, and we've had lots of people promising change from the left and from the right, but actually, in terms of things changing for people themselves, there's been relatively little, at least so far. And if I were Labour, I would be less concerned about millionaire businessmen, etc., etc., though that would still be a concern, and I'd be more concerned about the personal economic expectations that people have for the next 1, 2, 5 years.
Yes. I mean, do you think that satisfaction has sort of made us yearn for a hero and by extent become more gullible and willing to believe the impossible? I mean, Zia Yusuf of Reform tweeted the other day that a Reform government, under a Reform government, 100% of phone thieves will be caught and jailed. I mean, that's obviously nonsense, but some people seem to actively want to believe in fantasies.
The standard populist rhetoric has been for decades now, whatever you want to change will change, whatever you want to remain the same will remain the same, and that will be true at an individual level, you just have to vote for us. That's the playbook that Donald Trump has used with some success in the United States, though he is suffering himself now in the ratings, and it's the position that Nigel Farage and his outriders have adopted for many years now. It's very easy to say those sorts of things when you're not being held to account. It's very easy to say those things when you're campaigning to get into power. What Reform may find is that the more they promise, the more they have to deliver if they are in a position to do so. And they also have to rely on the fact that people trust them to do that. A lot of this is based on trust and beliefs around competence and effectiveness. Where Labour have really suffered since coming into office is that increasingly people believe that they are not operating in a fair way, an effective way, and a competent way. And that is a really damaging narrative and a long-lasting one that is difficult to turn around. But it's one that governments, as I say, across democratic countries are facing last year, the year before, and particularly this year.
Reform now claim to be the UK's biggest party by members. Supposedly, 270,000 or so have signed up, or that's what they say. Jeremy Corbyn's Labour had over 500,000 members and still lost the general election. So does that actually mean much?
Well, what I would say is that membership numbers are vanity and voting figures are sanity. That's the way to think about these things. There's no doubt that having an increase in membership, however you define that, is a good news story that gets people interested. We saw your party, the Jeremy Corbyn movement, pull a similar trick a few weeks ago, but actually it turned out there was a number of people who'd signed up for a newsletter. It was very opaque what they were actually talking about. But there's no doubt that more than 200,000 members and a big increase in membership is a positive story, and one that Nigel Farage and those at Reform will be pushing. But in terms of its long-term implications for voting, as you quite rightly mentioned, in 2019, Jeremy Corbyn had more than 500,000 members of Labour and they crashed to a record defeat. So it doesn't mean that you are guaranteed victory. For a start, members doesn't necessarily mean active members. And what you need if you're going to fight a national campaign is experience, but you also need a structure and people to actually do stuff, to get stuff done. And Reform has some people, and they brought over more people recently, but there's still, everything suggests, some way short of that strength in depth that is needed to fight not just a by-election campaign and not just a media war, but an actual general election campaign in 650 constituencies up and down the country.
Now, given that Keir Starmer has had not much success in persuading the public to come on his side, should Labour do what the Tories would usually do in this circumstance and replace him?
Well, the Tories haven't had a world of success with replacing leaders in the past, because it depends on who that replacement leader is and what difference they would be able to bring. The kind of economic constraints that Rachel Reeves and Keir Starmer have talked about the country being under are unlikely to go away significantly. The levers available to a replacement Labour leader are not likely to be hugely different from the ones Keir Starmer has. And so it might come down to style, it might come down to presentation, but fundamentally it's difficult to see how a new leader would make a lasting change to the kind of things that really matter to individual voters and their families. And there is no obvious person sitting in the wings in the way that, for instance, Boris Johnson was the last example of the Conservatives changing leader and it being a popular success. And so Andy Burnham has been talked about as from up in Manchester, but he, of course, does not even have a constituency and a seat in the House of Commons yet. So exactly how that would work would be complicated. Yes, you could have a by-election where he could stand, but that in itself would be a risk given Labour's popularity. And then if you don't go for him, do you go for someone in the Labour Party, parliamentary Labour Party at the moment? Again, there's no obvious person who has the kind of cut through that might bring around enormous change. Wes Streeting is obviously an option, but as I say, would Wes Streeting be significantly different in the eyes of the public from Keir Starmer? Potentially, it might make a small change, but when you look at the historical impact that a change in leader has, you're at most looking at a perhaps 5-point boost in the polls. In actual fact, that rarely lasts, and so it does represent a risk. And you can conduct hypothetical polls saying, oh well, what if this person were leader and things like that, but that again is vanity over sanity.
Good to talk to you, Joe. Thanks so much for that. Joe Twyman, director of polling agency Delta Poll. So what do you make of that? The Reform are now boasting that they have 270,000 members. As I was saying to Joe, Jeremy Corbyn had about double that when he was the leader of the Labour Party. And look what happened. So, you know, we are quite a way away from a general election. And if on current trajectory, if you can extrapolate from what's happening over the last, let's say, 3 months or so, to 3 years hence, then the Green Party is going to be forming the next government. And Reform are flying high at the moment, and they seem to be maintaining that lead of about 10 percentage points over Labour. Labour almost neck and neck with the Conservatives, the Lib Dems trailing, and the Greens have at least doubled their tally in the last 3 months or so since Zach Polanski came, for most of us, out of nowhere, and has become the nation's most popular leader of a political party. So I suppose it's all to play for. Do you think that Keir Starmer can actually affect some sort of turnaround in Labour's fortunes before the next general election? Do the Labour members need to fashion some sort of change at the top? And what about the Greens? Why do you think Zach Polanski has become so popular so suddenly? 0345 6060 973 LBC.
LBC.
There's an old Thai saying that roughly translates as, the family who takes the internet on holiday can locate a less crowded beach. Particularly handy, my friend, if it's peak mating season for nippy little crabs. Pack the internet with an eSIM from Aerolo. That's A-I-R-A-L-O.
Hey, Harry.
Hello, mate.
Got any tips for the football?
Your best bet is to head over to BetVictor. They're giving new customers a terrific welcome offer. If you bet a minimum of £10, they'll give you £30 in free bets.
Phil, that's a steal of a deal.
It's a good darn deal that'll make you squeal for real. Neil?
My name's not Neil.
I know, but it rhymes.
Listen to Harry and make your best bet on the football at BetVictor. 18 plus, opt in and bet on any football marketing at odds of evens or greater. No cash out, 7-day expiry. Terms and conditions apply. Again.
This is LBC with Nick Abbott. Call 0345 6060 973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
We're talking about the status of the political parties and their leaders, and it is interesting that Zach Polanski is the most popular leader of a major political party at the moment. Nigel Farage, I mean, except for the Prime Minister, Farage is the least popular leader of a major party. And yet, that party that he represents is leading the polls. Make some sense of that. 0345-6060-973. Carnforth, Annie.
Oh, hi, Nick.
Annie.
I think it's going to be quite interesting in the next election. I mean, I think we're either going to get a Reform government or, quite possibly, some combination of coalitions, either the Tories and Reform or, say, the Greens, the Lib Dems, the Scots Nats, Plaid Cymru, because they could do quite well in Wales. Possibly the Labour Party, but they don't really fit in with those other kind of parties that are on the left. And I think that's why they're so unpopular at the moment, because they seem too much like the Tories. You know, they're continuing with austerity. And I think people wanted... Well, they just wants to get rid of the Tories, and they wanted to get rid of austerity. And also, I think Keir Starmer was never popular anyway. Even before the election, he wasn't a popular leader. I think the only chance that the Labour Party might have is if Andy Burnham, by some miracle, did manage to get a seat and was elected as the leader, well, presumably as Prime Minister, because he is different. I mean, he's very popular for a start-up, but his policies would be different. He's not a Starmerite. They could replace Starmer with Wes Streeting. I don't think it would make any difference, because Wes Streeting is just another Starmerite in terms of policy. And he's not exactly charismatic either.
Well, that's the thing, is if they're going to replace Keir Starmer with somebody, then they'll have to replace him with somebody, and I don't mean in any way like him, but somebody... you know, of a sort of a Boris Johnson bent, somebody who can wave his arms around and attract attention.
Well, not necessarily. I mean, I think Andy Burnham is very popular, especially up here in the north, because of some of the lots of things he's done in Manchester. But he is a good speaker. He's quite an inspiring speaker.
Right. Well, that is what is signally lacking at the moment. I mean, Keir Starmer has qualities, no doubt about that, but inspiring is not one of them.
No, and I actually think that's why Zach Polanski is so popular, because he is a good speaker. He's always got an answer when he's on the media, and he pushes back. He's pushing back against the Reform anti-immigrant thing. He's pushing back against the sort of austerity thing of the Tories and Labour. He's saying, no, we should do a wealth tax. And also, obviously, people that care about the environment would he's got a lot going from him.
He seems like a real person, and
yes.
And many of the other political party leaders don't. I mean, you know, the Prime Minister is, well, he does come across like a real person, but a sort of a dull functionary. I'd say that Nigel Farage doesn't, to my eyes, doesn't really come across as a real person. He's more a performer. And so maybe that's right. Maybe that's the reason why Zach is polling so highly, is because people see him as a breath of fresh air. Oh, he's just like me. Good talk to you, Annie. I'm sorry, I've got to go, but thanks for that. Westminster, Hassan.
Yeah, hello. Hi. So look, I am was a lefty and got very disenchanted by Starmer, and I've been with the Greens, and I'm delighted by the Zach surge.
Why you joined the Greens?
No. Right. I joined the Greens because I thought that they were the most left-wing party, and I joined them to make sure that they become even more left-wing. And I was part of a group which made sure that Zach got elected, and we have a unapologetically left-wing solution of actually offering hope to the people of this country, rather than managerialism, which is what Starmer had to offer. And I think we are on track. We've tripled in size. We were 60,000 in September. We are 182,000 now. And I think by the time of the next local elections in May 26, we will be the largest party. Because as you've said, Corbyn had 600,000 members. Our policy platform is very similar to what Corbyn actually offered, which is a policy of hope, a policy of more investment in public services. We don't believe in blaming immigrants and people of different races for the country's ills. We want to invest in public services. So, and we expect to overtake Labour because Labour is declining sharply. Starmer actually said that he's changed the Labour Party and anybody who doesn't want to be in the party should leave. So people like me and many others left. And now we are sort of working with the Greens and we hope that we can offer an alternative vision because Starmer has really just been continuity Labour, continuity Tory, as far as we are concerned, and we want a clear divide.
I would question the validity of that statement, but some of the people who criticise Zach Polanski say that he's a bit like Nigel Farage in that he will offer fantasy solutions which can't actually pass scrutiny in the real world.
Look, I mean, it depends on what you mean by fantasy solutions. I mean, it's obvious to everyone that the super rich have become extremely wealthy in the past 5, 10, 15 years. And I think they need to pay a much larger burden towards public services than what they're doing right now. Now, you can call it fantasy politics or you can call it sort of classic labor redistribution. But somebody has to talk about it. And I think our policies, if you look at the Greens, are about climate change. I think it's very clear that has become that. I think it's about a cost of living. It's about more investment in NHS. We don't want to blame doctors as West Streeting does. So these are things that are widely popular amongst the general public.
Yes, well, they're particularly popular amongst young people. And that's the problem, I think, that Zach and the Greens will have. It's the getting the young out to actually vote on the day. But you must be delighted with the success that Zach Polanski has had by essentially doubling the polling numbers of the Green Party in such a short period of time. Thank you, Hassan. More of your calls on this, 0345-6060-973. That's to come. We're going to take a short break for the news. After that, Sadiq Khan has slammed Nigel Farage for trivialising accusations of racism made against him from his school days as banter. We'll talk about that and, as I say, get more of your thoughts on the state of the various political parties after the 1:30 news with Tim Daly.
Police investigating the terror attack on Jewish people at Bondi Beach in Australia say they're not looking for anyone else over the killings. 15 people plus the shooter were shot dead. The head of the UK's armed forces is due to warn the growing threats being faced by the country will require the whole nation to step up. Sir Richard Knighton says the general situation is the most dangerous he's ever seen in his career. And US media is reporting a man being held over the Brown University shooting in Rhode Island has a military background with no previous criminal record. Two people were shot dead on Saturday. LBC weather, heavy rain for the north and the west of England and Wales overnight. Clearer and less windy for Northern Ireland and the northwest of the UK. Dry in the southeast with a low of around 7 degrees.
This is LBC.
Take the world's best snooker players. One of the most unpredictable seasons. Add the electric atmosphere of Alexandra Palace. It can only be the 2026 Johnston's Paint Masters. Could it be Sean Murphy, Judd Trump, Neil Robertson, or world champion Zhao Zingtong who takes the trophy? One thing's certain. Nothing beats the Johnston's Paint Masters. Live. Enjoy our biggest ever fan zone. Watch in style from VIP sofas. Book now. WST.TV/tickets.
If you bought a home on a holiday park in the UK, what you thought you were getting may not be what you ended up with. From unexpected site fee increases, running costs, a huge depreciation in value, many owners feel they've been missold. If you think this might be you, holidayparkadvicecentre.co.uk could help you receive the compensation you're entitled to. Text ASSIST to 78900 to find out more. That's ASSIST to 78900.
At ulizprosperity.com, you buy the car and we pay you up to £600 per month in rental income. For conditions, visit ulizprosperity.com.
This festive season at McDonald's, get
rich deals every day.
Okay, okay.
With a sausage sandwich for just...
Let's see, 9 and MP.
Six chicken McNuggets for just...
9 and MP. Fine. Get Grinch deals every day
in the McDonald's app.
18 plus app only. Ends 24th of December. One use per offer. Fees apply to delivery. Participation varies. T's and C's apply.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
Sadiq Khan revealed the long-lasting impact of the racism that he faced as a teen as he criticised Nigel Farage for trivialising accusations against him from his school days as banter. He told LBC's Lewis Goodall, "It didn't feel like banter when I was called the P-word. It didn't feel like banter when people made me feel unwelcome in a country I was born and raised in, and that is so offensive." Let's talk about this with Femi Nylander. Femi is a filmmaker, activist and author and joins us on the line now. Hello, Femi.
Hi, how's it going?
Pretty good, thanks. Sadiq Khan says the racism he has suffered makes him critical of Nigel Farage's claim that the racism that he is accused of doling out to his fellow pupils at the private school that Farage went to was banter. Is it banter to pick on anyone, let alone children that are smaller than you, and abuse them for who they are?
No, I mean, it's not banter, and it's also, I mean, racism on the playground is one of the key markers, the key demonstrators of how it's intergenerational, how these people, I mean, where do people get this from if not from their parents, right? So the very rhetoric that Nigel Farage pushes today, because let's not pretend that Nigel Farage isn't still racist, let's not pretend that he didn't still have a big poster on the side of a lorry with pictures of brown people on it, talking about an invasion not that long ago, and that he isn't, him and Reform aren't behind whipping a lot of the hatred which comes up today, right? The racism on the playground is something that I experienced, something that I'm sure Sadiq Khan experienced, something that a lot of people experience. And kids aren't naturally racist. It comes from their parents. And it's an indictment, really. So I mean, I don't know what pushed Nigel to be goose stepping and doing this and doing that and the rest on the playground. But it certainly isn't banter when you're on the receiving end. No,
That's sort of letting Farage or somebody who has been accused of something like the things that he's been accused of kind of off the hook a bit by saying that it comes from the parents. Surely, at that kind of age that people said that he engaged in this kind of stuff, you've been able to form your own opinions.
Well, I mean, it depends, of course. It doesn't always come from the parents. I'm just making a comment generally about how, I mean, the kids that are going to with their parents today to hang out outside migrant hotels and harass asylum seekers are probably going to be bringing some of that to the playground with them. That's not to absolve Nigel Farage. Nigel Farage is now a fully fledged adult, and I understand that when he made some of these comments, he was quite well along in his teens. It's not to absolve him, and it's also like Nigel Farage should be and hopefully will be judged by the general public on his actions today. I mean, he does many things today which are racist. He has a long history of racist and anti-Semitic comments in the modern age. All this does is show the precedent. It shows that this is something that was building from his teenage years. It shows where this character came from. I'm sure there are plenty of people in the world today who were, during their school years, a certain type of person and who grew and who changed and who maybe shifted out of those habits. It's very clear to me that Nigel Farage has not. It's very clear to me that the views that he held in those days and the views that have been shown to be his views when he was a child, when it may have been more forgivable, when it may have been something that you say, okay, well, maybe it's his parents, maybe he's young, he's growing. And there's still the views he holds today. And anyone with two brain cells can see that, realistically. It's a shame that he holds so much support in the United Kingdom, because it means that a lot of people share those views.
Well, of course, Nigel Farage isn't here to defend himself, and he would push back on the comments that you made, and he has said that, he first of all, he didn't say these things, and if he did say them, then he didn't mean them in a bad way or a hurtful way, and that's his position. But do you think that perhaps instead of people getting their opinions from their parents, because, I mean, teenagers tend to act against their parents' wishes, they form opinions that are, you know, the opposite of their parents as part of the growing-up process, could people perhaps be getting their opinions from the media?
Yes, that's certainly the case as well. I mean, the media itself fuels a lot of this. And in those days, the media put a lot of it. And not just media, politicians. I mean, I'm not up to date on Farage's exact age, but I know that many years ago in the 70s, there was conservative politicians running on the line, if you want an N-word for your neighbour, vote Labour. Right? So this whole ecosystem of hatred against minorities, of anti-migrant sentiment, where migrant becomes kind of a buzzword for anyone who isn't white, for racism, obviously will impact the younger generation too. And if someone is, I used to sit on the train to school when I was a child, and the only thing that was in the train was the metro. I mean, it was in the buses. It wasn't in the train. It was in the bus. And I used to pick up the metro and read it. And I see some of the headlines that are in the metro today, some of the headlines that are in, and that's just the free one that you pick up on the bus. And it makes me think, well, if I hadn't been a little black kid and I'd been reading it at the time, maybe it would have made me think a certain way about migrants. Maybe it would have made me think a certain way about I remember the invasion of Libya was happening when I was at school, and that was in the newspapers. And my view of that now, having read and thought and study, there's a lot different with my view of it then. So, I mean, young people are very impressionable. And, of course, the media, but the young people as well, traditional media, newspaper media, they do engage with it less than they engage with social media, obviously.
Yes. Do you sort of get, I don't know how old you are, Femi, but I get a sense that the 1970s is returning. Do you think that the xenophobia of, let's say, the 1970s ever went away? Or did it just become socially unacceptable to express it?
No, I mean, the UK has always, I mean, if it had gone away, then it wouldn't have come back so easily, if you understand what I mean. If these views had gone away, if these views had actually, if the UK had actually kind of progressed and shifted out of its kind, and we don't just have to go back to the colonial, I mean, to the 1970s, we can trace this back to its source. The UK had an empire which told people around the world that the reason we can have an empire is because we're superior to these people, and the reason that we can go and dominate a quarter to half of the planet is because these people are tribalists, they're primitive, and we are civilized. And those views could continue to the 1970s and continue till today, and they never went away. It's just that at the moment we're seeing a resurgence in social acceptability.
Yes, do you think it's come full circle now with certain political figures and certain media outlets positively encouraging the hatred of others, of the weak and the people of minorities, which has sort of taken the lid off the pressure cooker and allowed people to say and do what they used to keep in for fear of disapproval from the rest of us?
Well, yeah, it's not just that. It is that, of course. And then it's obviously as well, when we see, it's not just what we do domestically, it's also what happens internationally as well, because the dehumanization, which is involved in kind of justifying involvement in certain foreign wars, certain elements of foreign aggression, certain images, when you see the media justifying kind of dead children for a very long period of time, and those children happen to be of another race, that also solidifies within people's heads, well, maybe these people are not as worthy as us, maybe they're not as deserving as us, maybe there's a reason for this happening. But yeah, of course, I think that the media in particular, and certain media figures, certain political figures, it's become more mainstream to be brass and open about it in recent years. But at the same time, it had never gone away. I mean, we talk about racism. The UK, we talk about a few years ago, was Brexit. And before Brexit, there was a massive sentiment even against other whites, if they weren't the right type of rights. There was this whole Polish coming here, stealing our jobs, taking this, that, and the rest. Need to kick them out. So this thing is not just emerged, if you understand what I mean. Xenophobia and racism have always been there. But I do think that it's bubbling over more, and it's not just in the UK. It's happening in the States. It's happening in continental Europe. It's becoming more and more mainstream.
Yes, I wonder if the less you have experience of others, the more fearful and the more hatred you express to the notion of being in their company. Because, you know, the most successful areas in the country are the big cities, and the big cities in this country are very integrated. I mean, London is something like 40% of people who aren't white British, and London is the most vibrant and exciting city in the land, and you could say the same is more or less true for the other big cities in this country. So we're not a racist country, it's just that some people, mostly from areas that don't have immigrants or visible minorities, they appear to be the most vehemently opposed to them.
I mean, it depends. I think that you can still find high levels of racism in places like Bradford, where you essentially have a lot of segregation between the communities. And so you can still find areas where there is a high minority community. However, for some reason or the other, and you look at the United States as well, the United States is one of the most racist places in the world in many markers. And you'd often find white neighborhoods and black neighborhoods are right next door to each other. But there's a lot of, there's social segregation, there's class segregation, there's housing segregation. And so people who are two blocks away from each other or two streets away from each other geographically feel very far away from each other because they don't go to the same schools. And you do find elements of this in the UK as well. If you go to London, which is a very multicultural place, you'll still find that there are a lot of schools in certain areas that are almost all black, because that's the way the schooling system works to some degree. And you'll find other schools that are more mixed. But of course, it is the case that it's easier to make a boogeyman and to make someone seem like a strange outsider if you go to certain areas in the country, in rural areas where no one's ever seen a black person, right? But I don't think that that places like London, places like Birmingham, magical kind of racial harmony utopias necessarily, because there is still a lot of structural racism which occurs, whereby you will find that the black population of such cities, a lot of the minority population of such cities face issues such as gentrification. I don't know if people have probably heard of gentrification, but if people who are listening don't know, that's where minority communities get pushed to the outskirts of a major city as kind of people with greater purchasing power come in and take all of the prime real estate. All of these things exist in an urban setting as well, in mixed communities. But I do think that there is something to be said about communities mixing with each other, taking away racism. I mean, in my primary school, I believe I think there was another mixed race black boy. And then there was my little brother, who's also lighter than me. But at one point, I was the only person. I mean, I'm three quarters black and one quarter white, but I look just African. And so I was thinking, at one point, I was the only kind of very, very visibly black person in my school. And I think that, I'd like to think. I mean, I have friends from my school, and I know that their parents had some very dodgy views, and they were friends with me. And I'd like to think that them being friends with me and having at least one other black person kind of within their friendship group might have helped them to not take up racist views.
Yeah.
And I do think that kind of thing. I think there's a case to be made for that, but I do also think that it's you can't just say that the UK is not racist because people of colour live in the same place as white people.
But it does seem to be, but it does seem to be that the fewer people that have non-white faces, then the more extreme is the fear from the white residents of the introduction of non-white faces. Because, I mean, look, Clacton, which is where Farage won his seat, it's something like 97.9% white British. So the idea that they are concerned about immigration is kind of laughable, because the only non-white face that you'd see in Clacton is the man behind the counter in the Indian takeaway.
Well, this is it, and I do agree that there's it's easier to, because the main thing as well is that this is about a boogeyman. This is about distracting from the realities of why people are seeing economic downturn in this country. Why people are struggling. The inequality. The kind of very 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 hard right. Very, very, very intensely neoliberal economics, which basically makes the poor poorer and the rich richer, and finding a bogeyman to blame their troubles on, and saying, well, the reason is that these people are coming in, they're stealing your jobs, and they're violating your women and any other story that they want to make up. And when you actually meet a few of these people and you realise, oh, they're just people like us, then that helps
sort of breaks the spell. Yeah, good to talk to you, Femi. Thanks so much for that, Femi Nylander, the filmmaker, activist, and author. Now we're going to take a short break, then I'll come back and more of your thoughts on why you think that Nigel Farage polls so low as far as his personal popularity is concerned, and yet the party he represents is polling so high, and conversely, why Zach Polanski is apparently, according to this poll that I'm looking at, is the most popular of the leaders of the top five political parties, and yet the Greens, which is his party, are at the bottom of the pile. 0345-6060-973 LBC.
LBC. This week on Nick Ferrari at Breakfast. Chris, you're through to the Commissioner.
Just curious to think if you believe Donald Trump was right to criticise the Econ.
He said that he was a nasty person. He also talked about the crime that engulfs London. Commissioner.
There's no no-go areas. That's completely false. I think how anybody in America can suggest the UK is violent is completely ridiculous.
Plus, a cry from the heart from Health Secretary Wes Streeting to doctors poised to strike.
We've made a lot of progress together, not just on pay and on jobs, but on the NHS itself. Don't put that recovery at risk.
A New Year's resolution.
Let's try and start 2026 with a fresh start. We could all do without this war of words.
Nick Ferrari at Breakfast. Back tomorrow morning from 7. Listen on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app.
Waitrose presents...
I really fancy a mince pie.
One man's selfless journey... From sofa to kitchen.
Oh, they go up.
For a number one golden mince pie with juicy golden raisins, cherries and apricots, and zesty limoncello.
With some cream.
For a number one golden mince pie with juicy golden raisins, cherries and apricots, zesty limoncello, and a dollop of fresh cream.
Limoncello.
Waitrose, the home of food lovers. Selected stores subject to availability.
Think about cheese. Make your thoughts cheesier. Now add 100% chicken breast fillet, chipotle sauce and a mega cheese melt. And it's giving the new cheesy chicken stack at McDonald's. Did we mention it's cheesy?
Cheese!
Available until the 4th of Jan 2026 from 11 a.m. Price and participation may vary, subject to availability.
Caught in the chaos of Christmas, fearing crimbo limbo, Radio Times has your festive entertainment sorted. That's one less thing to worry about. So you can focus on wrapping the presents and buying the turkey. Pick up the Christmas issue for your 14-day guide to the best TV, streaming, film, radio and podcasts. Plus, plenty of reviews, recommendations and star-studded exclusives at your fingertips. It wouldn't be Christmas without Radio Times. On sale now.
Brands that use radio are 49% more likely to get noticed. Amplify your advertising at radiocentre.org. Assuming you want to get noticed.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060973.
We are talking about the state of the political parties, why Zach Polanski is polling so highly and yet the party he represents polls so relatively low, and vice versa with Nigel Farage. 0345 6060973. Bath. Hello, Laura.
Hi, Nick. You okay?
Yes, good, thanks.
So... human beings, we're fundamentally simple creatures. I think we vote with our gut. I mean, we can discuss policy standpoints of each politician, but I genuinely don't think the public are actually that interested in the day-to-day demands of what is required to fix this country. As you've alluded to yourself, like, Labour have been doing some good things, and yet Starmer remains dreadfully unpopular. Whereas we know populism works well, and I think people are unhappy and they want radical change, which is what, better or worse, Farage and Polanski are promising.
Yes, I think Aaron Banks summed it up best. He was one of those bad boys of Brexit, and he was talking about how to get people on side during the Brexit referendum, and he said... facts are just white noise to people. We're all about feelings now, which is pretty much exactly what you said.
Yeah, and I don't think it is... with the world we live in and how fast-paced it is, I think it is far be it from people to keep up with the individual runnings of the government and what it takes. And but I can understand the drive to want to rally behind a person, because at the end of the day, we can look at the differences between the popularity of a party versus the person. But I just think it's easier to rally behind a person. And I share your view, and I felt the same about Boris Johnson, that Boris Johnson and Nigel Farage apparently have some sort of likability and this sort of guy you could have a drink with at the pub-esque thing about them. Never understood that. I genuinely think they're both so incredibly out of touch. But we know that they have this effect on the population.
Well, it's just enough members of the population it has that effect on. But I wonder if the act, and I do think that both of them, Johnson and Farage, have an act. I wonder if by a factor of constant constantly seeing them do it, it becomes less and less effective over time. Whereas Zach Polanski seems more like a real person.
Yeah, certainly. And a bit of food for thought for you would be that you mentioned that Reform obviously are polling quite high, but Nigel Farage as an individual isn't. That maybe people aren't being as honest in these polls as they really feel. We know that's been the case before. It is maybe, it could be said, embarrassing perhaps to rally behind Nigel Farage, but you might actually like Reform, but maybe these people that are filling out the polls are not being wholly honest.
Well, that's an interesting thought. Okay, thanks, Laura. Stratford-upon-Avon. Hello, Jane.
Hello, Nick.
Jane.
Excuse me, I bunged up nose. I would like to say I thought that the last hour of your programme has been extraordinarily interesting. I've liked all of it. I really, really like the guy called Femi that you talked to before the advert break.
Oh, yes.
What a nice chap. And entirely right in everything he said, I felt. And actually, that sort of goes back a little bit to when Diane Abbott wrote her letter to The Observer, and she wasn't supported by Starmer and the Labour Party. What Diane Abbott was saying was correct. She just said it in a very clumsy way. Anyway, so to get back to Starmer, what I'm hoping, and I think I'm probably right, when it comes to actually putting your X in the box on polling day, there is an element of, well, certainly in the people, definitely in me and the people that I'm very close to, and we talk about politics, you don't want to, in inverted commas, waste your vote.
Yeah.
So I don't know. On one occasion, the MP that was from my constituency, a Labour MP, I wasn't a fan of his. And I was toyed with the idea of voting Green. This is quite a long time ago now.
Right.
And I didn't, because I thought, oh, no, it's just a waste of the vote.
Yes.
Mind you, where I live, voting Labour is a waste of a vote as well. We ended up with, that guy, who I can't remember his name, that Tory chap that got kicked out in the last election.
Well, you'll have to narrow it down for us. but things have changed, haven't they? With the Greens, well, particularly, it won't feel like a wasted vote. Not if they're polling at they're rising vertiginously.
I've got a hope in my soul that we've got 3.5 years yet before we have to have an election. I'm really hoping that Starmer and Reeves. You're talking about charismatic politicians. I can't think of any on either side of the main parties at all at the moment, to be honest with you. I can't, I'm trying to think last about when I last thought of anybody as being terribly charismatic. Mm. It's a long time ago.
But we had people with charisma, didn't we? I mean, Boris Johnson has charisma pouring out of every cell of his body.
Not for me. I didn't ever think of him as charismatic. I thought of him as an entitled prat.
Well,
I couldn't bear him. Somebody just said, you could go to the pub with him and Farage.
Well, no,
I couldn't go to the pub with either of them, I'm afraid.
But it is indisputable that the country, for a certain while there, was enamoured with Boris Johnson's act. But I just thought that after all that chaos, after all the changes that the Tory party wrought on us, it's like every week there was somebody new in number 10, it felt, that a period of calm was called for. But as soon as we got one, everybody threw their toys out of their pram and said, well, can we go back to something more interesting?
No, 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 they haven't yet. Well, this is what I'm hoping. I'm hoping now. I don't think Keir Starmer is charismatic. That doesn't bother me. I like the fact that he's sensible and you know, will sort of put his shirt and tie on and come out in the morning with quite a serious face and deal with very serious issues. I like it.
Right.
I don't want an idiot that's got to fluff his hair up and start talking about Peppa Pig. I'm not interested in that.
Because but we've been there. Yes. Go on.
Well, what I'm hoping with Labour is what that they will, not yet, but within the next 18 months, start putting in some of the Green Party policies that I agree with, like charging the extraordinarily wealthy companies and putting some money back in the pockets of working folk so that suddenly they can think, oh, when I take my salary home or my wages home, there is some spare cash.
Yes.
Things are improving. And Labour could still do that.
Well, yes, I mean, they've got no end of time, really. You could say that the difficult work has been done early, and they've disappointed people because he's, like I've said before, he's not a wizard. He might look like Harry Potter's dad, but you know, he doesn't have a magic wand to just wave and make everything magically better. But after a period of disappointment, having sort of laid the groundwork, then it is possible that, you know, something better may come. Thanks, Jane. Sorry I couldn't get to all of your calls or messages. Plenty of opportunities to talk about this subject ahead on LBC. But coming up after the news, The Telegraph reports that shoppers spent £500 million more on meat this year than the year before. They say people are shunning meat-free options. A study says that a growing number of supermarket customers switched back to beef, lamb, pork and poultry from the vegetarian options that were available to them. Does this suggest that vegetarianism and veganism is ebbing as a lifestyle? 0345-6060-973, Friday, Saturday, Sunday night at 10, Nick Abbott, LBC.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at midnight. Police in Australia say the people who died in the anti-Semitic gun attack at Bondi Beach were aged between 10 and 87 years old. 15 were killed, while the 50-year-old shooter was also shot dead by police. His son is now under guard in hospital after being detained at the same time. The Premier of New South Wales is Chris Minns.
We need to send a strong and clear repudiation of anti-Semitism in all of its forms. In all of its forms, there is no tolerance for racism or Jewish hatred in New South Wales or Australia, and we need to be clear and unambiguous that we will fight it everywhere we see it.
Australia's Prime Minister has announced flags will be flying at half-mast around the country. The King has said he's appalled and saddened by the attack. The Sydney-based reporter Jack Hahn has been telling LBC the scenes from Bondi Beach won't be forgotten.
For 9 minutes, we had the sound of gunfire ringing out through Bondi, and harrowing vision shows these two assailants perched up on somewhat of an elevated position on a bit of a bridge and just opening fire.
The head of the UK's armed forces is due to warn the growing threats being faced by the country will mean the whole nation needs to step up. Sir Richard Knighton says the general situation is the most dangerous he's ever seen in his career. More now from LBC's Laura Makin-Isherwood.
Sir Richard is due to tell an audience there now needs to be a society-wide approach to defence and deterrence. He'll also raise the state of the armed forces, saying readiness is a priority. On top of that, the matter of Russia will be raised with the assessment it wants to challenge, limit, divide and ultimately destroy NATO. But Sir Richard's words will also be aimed at the public, especially when he says defence doesn't just mean our military and government stepping up.
Five people have been arrested in Syria following the deaths of two US service personnel on Saturday. A civilian interpreter was also killed during the attacks, being linked to so-called Islamic State. And it's being reported the man arrested over Saturday's shooting at a US university has a military background. Two people died after shots were fired inside a classroom at Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island. LBC weather, more heavy rain for Wales, Western and Northern England during Monday. Showers in northwestern Scotland, but mostly fine across the southeast of England. We'll see a high during the day of around 12 degrees. From Global's newsroom, for LBC, I'm Tim Daly.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Nick Abbott.
The Telegraph reports that shoppers spent £500 million more on meat this year than last year. They say a growing number of us bought beef, lamb, pork and poultry this year, while, they say, shunning meat-free options. Let's talk about this with Saffron Gloyne. Saffron is a vegan and animal rights activist and joins us on the line now. Hello, Saffron.
Hi, Nick.
Did you read this report in the Telegraph?
I did.
Would I be wrong in thinking that it seems a bit like propaganda on behalf of the meat industry? Because the truth is that we may have spent more on meat this year, but fewer of us bought meat. It's just that those few spent more because the price has gone up.
I'm really glad you said that, because as soon as I saw the Telegraph, I thought, oh, God, anyone with critical thinking skills would read this with a healthy amount of cynicism. And that was exactly my first thought. So I did a little bit of research. And yes, to the surprise of no one, a lot of this data came from the meat industry. And my second thought was, well, everything's gone up in price. By quite a large amount. So it wouldn't surprise me if that gap in money spent is actually because meat is much more expensive, especially beef, than what it was a year or two ago. But there are other aspects to this as well, and they're not completely wrong. And so I don't want to kind of storm in and go, this is all a complete lie and it's all propaganda, as you say, although, you know, it is slanted in that direction.
It certainly reads as though more we are sort of fallen back in love with meat and out of love with meat-free options. But the number that I got
was they're interpreting the data, aren't they? To their slant. You know, the facts are more money's been spent than this time last year on meat. That there's no, and then they've invented this fairy tale behind why that's happened. You know. Oh, we've fallen back in love with meat. It's simply not the case. I think, yes, there has been a shrink in the purchase of plant-based meats, but that's not any reflection on how people feel about animals, about their diets and about veganism. I think, you know, there is, I certainly, when I first went vegan, you know, a few years ago, I was anything that had vegan written on it, I would buy it. I was like, vegan is vegan, I must buy it, and I must only eat that. And then you kind of relax and you think, actually, a lot of foods are just vegan. Potatoes are vegan, mushrooms are vegan, you know, all these things that you ate anyway are vegan. And you slowly settle in and cook your own foods and make and start being inventive with your cooking. And so that initial rush to buy meat replacements kind of calms down a little bit. And I think that's what we've been seeing as well.
Yes, I mean, just to put the nail in that argument, the volume of beef sold actually went down. Mm. So we bought less of it. Yet the amount we spent on beef went up 418 million. So we're buying less because it's more expensive.
I mean, that almost on its own, explains that data point. And the reason it's so expensive is because people are turning away from it because, you know, and I'm not saying this from an animal rights point of view, but from a climate, it's catastrophic for our climate. And people who aren't vegans even acknowledge that. And there are meat eaters that will say, but I won't eat beef because it is so destructive to our planet. And I have children and I want them to have a breathable planet in 50 years, you know. So And to compensate for this, to compensate for the sales dipping, they are forced to put the prices up. So, and also inflation and all the other things that affect market forces. So what the Telegraph have done is taken this very, very small piece of information, this percentage, and knitted around it this story about everybody, you know, buying meat again. It wouldn't surprise me at all. I haven't seen anything, but it wouldn't surprise me if that article was printed next to a meat industry advert or pork or something like that. It wouldn't surprise me at all, because when I delve deeper into the article, I must admit, and I won't lie, I didn't read all of the article because it was behind a paywall and you'd have to string me up before I would give money to the Telegraph. But I did deep dive into where that data came from, and I'm not going to say the names of the companies, but a number of companies came up, and then I went through onto their websites, and their websites were talking about, you know, yes, there's been a shrinkage, and we're not saying that veganism is bad, but we are saying source of protein, la la la, usual.
Yes. So approach this story with skepticism, but there are some things that are true. Historical health scares did depress the sale of beef since the 1980s, people like mad cow disease, and people concerned about cholesterol and the fat content of beef. So that's understandable. So why has the vegetarian option, which is supposedly the healthier option, also seen a decline in sales?
Well, like I said, it's not vegetarian option. It's vegan meat specifically. It's first of all, new vegans, after a while realizing that they can use tofu, they can cook their own meals. They don't have to turn to these very expensive plant-based meats. They're seen more of a treat rather than a daily staple. And also because people are, when they're going vegan for their health, they're kind of turning away from processed foods. And a lot of vegan foods are processed as well. That's not to say that animal-based foods aren't processed, but if you are thinking health-wise, you're going to do a vegetable stir fry rather than have a McPlant burger from McDonald's.
Although as a country we seem to be obsessed with watching programs on television about how to cook fabulous things while we eat a ready-made meal that we bought at the supermarket, and those vegetarian or vegan option ready-made meals, is it true that they are selling less of them because of the concern for ultra-processed food?
I think it would be dangerous to put it down to one thing, but I will say this, from personal experience, I have been frustrated by and noticed the fact that the range is shrinking. We had this fabulous utopia of year around 2022 when there was so much choice and it was so wonderful. And I thought, well, this is now what it's going to be. And the last Veganuary, 2025 January, I was very underwhelmed by it. Normally that's the month of the year, there's loads of new ranges, it's very exciting, and I was really underwhelmed. And I've noticed throughout the year that there has been less choice and they are scaling back on these products. So it's not necessarily that people aren't buying it, it's that it's not available. I mean, I have.
But surely the one leads to some. Sorry to interrupt, but surely the one has led to the other. They're not available because people have stopped buying them.
Yeah. I mean, again, my cynicism. I think we drive the markets. I'm not sure that's the case. I think the people that decide where the markets go drive the markets. You know, I walked into several supermarkets in the last few months, the little ones, the express ones, and walked out again because there's nothing for me to buy in terms of vegan fast food, which is what I walked in there for. And if you'd have told me that 2 years ago, I wouldn't have believed you, because it was literally everywhere.
Well, it is a very specific product, though, isn't it? It's like a line that moves slowly, which generally don't get put in those mini supermarkets. It's like if you want something exotic.
A long time.
Okay. Well, they tried it, and apparently it didn't work, which is odd, because if people are shunning vegetarian and vegan foods, particularly those ones that mimic meat, because they are ultra-processed foods, and, you know, people are rightly concerned about that, it is odd, then, that the sales of ultra-processed foods in general has shot up in the last, let's say, 5 years. 57% of the calories we consume were ultra-processed food in 2018. Now it's 63%. So the sales of stuff that's bad for us have gone up, not down, and yet people are ascribing the poor sales of vegan foods, and, you know, you could put the sort of non-dairy milk substitutes in that category. They appear to have fallen away. So is it maybe that vegetarians and vegans are more particularly concerned about what they eat because of having made that choice than people who are generally not that bothered? If it looks nice, they'll have it.
I think there's two separate things there. First of all, you need to separate out plant milks from the rest of vegan foods, because plant milks, the boom has never stopped and it will never stop, and the dairy industry is on its arse, you know, and there will be an end to that eventually, and I think it's different from vegan foods and vegan meats, but if you look at vegan foods particularly, you answered your own question at the very beginning when you said, is it just propaganda? Because it's the reason we're consuming much more ultra-processed food is because everything is ultra-processed now. This is the world that we live in. And if you think meat, and people say, oh, well, meat isn't processed. Well, what about the antibiotics and the pus and the blood? And all of everything that goes into factory farming is ultra-processed. But they're saying vegan meat's ultra-processed. That's propaganda. That's people going, oh, this is why you shouldn't eat it, because it's so, so bad for you and it's so processed. Well, so is everything so processed. But I think there's this media frenzy putting a label on it, and, you know, and that is coming from somewhere. And every time you drill down to where these stories are coming from, then at the bottom of it, somebody's wants to make money off you buying their product as opposed to the competitor's product. Yeah, and 9 times out of 10, that's the meat industry.
Right. Well, the milk substitute industry is an interesting one, because that exploded out of almost nothing at all.
You see, the way you're phrasing that, milk substitute, plant milk is milk. It's not a substitute.
Okay,
is it?
It's not what people would normally think of as milk, so that's why I'm saying it. So I don't, it's like, okay, oat milk and hemp milk and almond milk and all that stuff. It did explode, the space that supermarkets gave it on the shelves became bigger and bigger and bigger until it seemed to reach a zenith. And even the Swedish oat drink maker Oatly, in October, they slashed their sales forecasts, and in their words, the future was doom and gloom. And they ascribed their shrinking fortunes to concern about climate change, meaning that people no longer thought of that product as sustainable.
Which source are you going? I struggle to believe that any company that's listed on the stock market for the first of all would say we predict doom and gloom for our company. So I wonder.
I actually misspoke. What they said was doom and gloom around climate change, rather than their own financial future.
Yes, there is doom and gloom around climate change, and that's precisely why people are going to plant-based products. If Oatly have reduced their sales, it's not because people aren't buying it. It is because the market is saturated. People are jostling for position because there are so many brands out there, which is wonderful. But there's no plant milk is not going away, and it's not going to stop. Even people who are meat eaters, even people who aren't vegans, are turning to plant milk because of the massive, massive impact that dairy has, as you said, on climate change. And people are depressed about it. We're at a tipping point where you can't even deny it anymore. The floods, the forest fires, you know, the world is literally on fire. And you can't ignore it anymore. And cutting out dairy is the easiest, simplest and cheapest way to reduce this problem, to get away from that day zero. And people are waking up to that. I promise you, Nick, plant milk isn't going anywhere. If anything, it's getting bigger. And you can walk into any supermarket and see that right in your face, you know, every aisle. The long life, if you go into supermarkets and look at the long life milks, there are one shelf each for semi and skimmed for cow's milk, and everything else is a plethora of varieties of everything from oat to soya to almond to pea.
I tried them all. Pea milk.
Yeah,
that's a new one on
milk.
Me. Haven't tried. I tried all of the others.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry to say I went back to cow milk. But you're not alone, of course, in choosing to become a vegan, because between 2014 and 2020, the number of vegans in the UK quadrupled.
Yes.
Being one of those, a late convert, as you've said, do you miss anything about eating meat?
No. You couldn't shove it down my throat with a rusty spade, to be honest. It's not a health thing for me. I'm not a particularly healthy person. I don't really care. For me, it's completely ethical. And once you make that connection about what you're putting in your mouth, when it is ethical, you cannot go back. I know there are people that miss tastes and flavours, and you know, there's no slight on those people, and that's what these alternatives are for. If you pushed me on a really low day, yeah, I'd miss a bit of tuna, actually. I used to like a bit of tuna. But there are alternatives now that, honestly, no word of a lie, tastes exactly the same. So that's it. Oh, and the other thing I missed was Heinz tomato soup. You know, the tin soup?
Mm-hmm.
And they a couple of years ago, they brought out a vegan version. Oh, gosh, it's wonderful. So that's it. I'm done. tuna and tomato soup, I'm happy.
Right. Good talking to you, Saffron. Thanks so much for that. Saffron Gloyne, vegan and animal rights activist. So, we'll take the Telegraph story with a pinch of salt. They said that the shoppers spend £500 million more on meat this year than last year, and their take was that meat is staging a comeback. People are stopping eating vegetarian foods and so on. The truth is probably more simple, that meat costs more. We're buying less of it, but we're paying more for it. Have you chosen to eat more or less meat this last year, and why have you made that decision? And much has been made of consuming protein lately. People are on various diets, they're bulking up because they see their favourite influencer online telling them to eat more protein. And, of course, there's the what they call the fat jabs, and the sort of odd or special diet that comes with taking those things. Can you get the protein you need without eating animal products, I wonder? And have you changed your diet because of reasons other than taste in the last year? And what's odd is that after all the talk of ultra-processed food, why do you think we eat more of it in this country than almost any other country on Earth? 0345-6060-973. LBC.
Weekdays from 7 a.m.
They come here because they know it's a soft touch.
Straight to the point.
How does this even add up?
Nick Ferrari at breakfast on LBC.
This is a Whitehall farce, without any doubt.
Listen on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app. Download it now from your app store. LBC.
Every investor has a future in mind, whether it's seeing your kids through uni or picturing yourself retiring in Tuscany. The hard part can be knowing how to get there. JP Morgan Personal Investing can help you see the path ahead. With our intuitive app, expert support, and 150 years of JP Morgan's investing experience, you can start making more informed investment decisions today. Search JP Morgan Personal Investing. Invest with clarity. Capital at risk.
What should you put on your Christmas list this year? Aldi! We're Quality Food Award Christmas Retailer of the Year for the sixth year in a row! And which cheapest supermarket of the year 4 years running? Get Christmas all wrapped up at Aldi. Visit aldi.co.uk/awards for more.
40 million people listen to commercial radio each week. That's 80 million ears, give or take. Amplify your advertising at radiocentre.org.
This is LBC with Nick Abbott.
So perhaps the death of vegan food has been somewhat overstated, but it appears as though at least we're spending more on meat than we were last year. It's probably a function of meat costing more. Beef, anyway, is being bought in smaller numbers, but it, as you will have noticed if you've been to the supermarket lately, the price of it has gone through the roof. That's the reason why we're spending more on it. We're just buying less and paying more. 0345-6060-973. Pete says, if you're not meant to eat cows, then why are they made from yummy beef? Most vegans I know gave it up as they struggled to carry a potato and half a pound of lentils home for the supermarket. Right, well, I'm sure people will have something to say about that. Tavistock, hello, Rose.
No, I couldn't be bothered, Nick, I'm afraid.
Okay.
Oh, darling, I made you laugh. How wonderful. No, well, for me, it's, I mean, I look at a cow or anything else that's a live creature, and it's just a fellow creature, and to help subsidise the suffering in slaughterhouses and often in the lives they lead, it just seems bizarre. And especially so when I've heard dairy cows calling night after night for the young calves taken so that the cows could be milked.
Mm.
One in Cumbria once followed me as I walked round the perimeter of her field. I was on the outside of the fence. And she'd lost her voice from calling out. She was mouthing this cry and looking at me frantically. And I just said, I haven't got it. I don't know where your calf is.
Mm.
Meanwhile, my friend not far away was apologised to by a farmer who said, "Afraid it's going to be a noisy week, Lorna. We're taking the calves away today." All he cared about was, you know, inconsiderate to the neighbours. One day, this was a strange experience, actually. At my previous home here in Devon, I just walked up to a field a few yards away, and about 16 young calves were there. They were exquisitely beautiful. They were like, almost like you'd seen a fawn, you know, a young deer, all different shades of light brown and white. And some were so young, they were still unsteady on their feet. And they're being fed a milk substitute, sort of, you know, the chap came once or twice a day.
Yeah.
And they were, did I say they were still unsteady on their legs? Yes. Mm-hmm. That's what struck me. And there they all were, and somewhere the cows were calling out for them. And I just think, what a species we are.
But
and a lot of these animals are kept indoors.
Right. But in that respect, I mean, the farming part is unique to humans, but everything beneath us on the food chain kills something for its dinner, apart from, you know, the ones that are just vegetarians.
Yes. But we're humans, and we don't. We can think. We can feel empathy.
Yes, but just by the location of our eyes in our head, we're hunters. So everything that is alive that has the same sort of features of ocular vision kills things. So it's sort of in us.
Well, we killed them. Hopefully, fairly quickly. We didn't have them herded off to slaughterhouses, terrified because they knew what was happening to them. We didn't have them immobilized so they never see the outdoors and just keep providing calves, which goes on an awful lot now. They can't even move. I mean, we're savages, quite frankly. And I'm not terribly interested in where we've come from. I just don't want to be causing suffering totally unnecessarily.
All right, good to talk to you, Rose. Thanks for that. 0345-6060-973. Judy in Connecticut says, I'm a vegan and have never missed a meat substitute. I was in London this summer and enjoyed some of the best plant-based food restaurants in the world. I'm part of a vegan community from around the world, and the UK is often cited as very progressive in the plant-based food world. I did not know that. Letchworth. Hello, Harry.
Good morning. I think your last caller summed up why I could never be either vegetarian or vegan, because quite frankly, the way that it is rammed down our throats that we're evil and everything else, you know, it doesn't work for me. I actually asked my GP last year whether changing to a meat-free diet would help my health? And he said, well, it might, but he said, by the time you've bought all the additional vitamins and minerals that you will need, because they are not in a vegetarian or vegan diet, you'll be well out of pocket. So that's just one point. The other point is that I live alone, I'm disabled, and when I go shopping, I have to go for the ultra-processed ready meals, because you cannot now buy food in the sort of quantities that one person would want. You know, if I wanted, for example, 2 rashers of bacon, I've got to buy a pack of 8 rashers.
Right.
You know,
and a lot of the deals in supermarkets are for, you know, buy one, get one free, which is not appropriate, really, for anybody that doesn't have a large family.
That's it, you know. I mean, it's just a lack of consideration, I think, is probably the best way of putting it, because I'm old enough to know, or to remember, when I could go and do shopping for my parents, and I'd go into the butcher's and I could get a single pork chop or, you know, whatever I wanted. I could get as much or as little veg from the greengrocer.
And you actually had a fishmonger's in the high street, and that's
well,
all gone.
Yes, I mean, I smile when people talk about supermarket fishmongers having fresh fish. You know, if it was caught on day one of a 2-week fishing expedition by a large trawler, it ain't fresh.
Yes. So that's one of the reasons why I like frozen fish, because I'm fairly confident that it was, at least when it was frozen, it was fresh.
Yeah. Yeah, that's fair enough. And I also share your repulsion at these flavoured milks. I mean, if we, you know, if you'd been intended to drink flavoured milk, it would have been invented years ago.
Well, I did. I'm sure it's a difficult process, and I know that the ingredients are quite large, but you could say that there's a lot of stuff in milk that it doesn't, that is not described on the bottle. But I went through them all. I thought, you know, it's time to stop drinking milk. I'll experiment. And I tried almond milk and the other nut milks and hemp milk and every kind of milk that you could imagine. I found all of them to be absolutely inedible.
Well, we had a little, it was just a very small little coffee shop which only sold coffee with flavoured milk. But being not unreasonable, I thought, well, I'll give it a try. And I went in, ordered a coffee with almond milk.
Yes.
I had probably 2 mouthfuls.
And you left
got
it
up
there.
And walked out. You
right.
know, it's...
Well, at least you tried, Harry. Thanks for that. I've got to go. More of your calls on this to come. Have you changed your dietary habits dependent on something other than taste? Are people online, these so-called influencers, are they persuading you to change your diet? Maybe increase the amount of protein you are eating? Because apparently internet searches on grocery sites for protein products has gone through the roof in the last year or so, and I wonder why that is, unless people are being persuaded to do it by these so-called influencers. And I am curious, with all the talk of ultra-processed food and the sort of common understanding that it is bad for us, we in this country are apparently the third largest consumers of ultra-processed food in the world. So why is that? 0345 6060 973. In the half hour to come, we are also going to get a weather update. And we'll be joining Simon Marks, our Washington correspondent, for the latest from there. It is just past 12:30 on LBC, the news headlines with Tim Daly.
Police in Australia say the people who died during the anti-Semitic gun attack at Bondi Beach were aged between 87 and 10 years old. 15 were killed. Australia's Prime Minister has announced flags will be flying at half-mast. The head of the UK's armed forces is to warn the general security situation in the world is the most dangerous he's ever seen in his career. Sir Richard Knighton speech later on will also say the growing threats mean the whole nation needs to step up. And five people have been arrested in Syria following the deaths of two US service personnel on Saturday. A civilian interpreter was also killed during the attack linked to so-called Islamic State. LBC weather, heavy rain for the north and west of England and Wales as well overnight, becoming clearer and less windy in Northern Ireland and the northwest of the UK, dry in the southeast with a low of around 7 degrees.
This is LBC.
Every investor has a future in mind, whether it's seeing your kids through uni or picturing yourself retiring in Tuscany. The hard part can be knowing how to get there. JP Morgan Personal Investing can help you see the path ahead. With our intuitive app, expert support, and 150 years of JP Morgan's investing experience, you can start making more informed investment decisions today. Search JP Morgan Personal Investing. Invest with clarity. Capital at risk.
What should you put on your Christmas list this year? Aldi! We're Quality Food Award Christmas Retailer of the Year for the sixth year in a row. And which cheapest supermarket of the year 4 years running? Get Christmas all wrapped up at Aldi. Visit aldi.co.uk/awards for more.
40 million people listen to commercial radio each week. That's 80 million ears, give or take. Amplify your advertising at radiocentre.org.
Leading Britain's conversation, Nick Abbott. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
We are talking about diets, specifically because the Telegraph printed a paper, they printed a story in that paper that said that shoppers are spending £500 million more on meat this year than last year. Their take was that we have fallen back in love with meat, but the truth is more prosaic. I think that it's just that the price of meat's gone through the roof. And beef particularly is being left on the shelf, or actually, more accurately, they're not putting it on the shelf anymore because we're buying less of it. Poultry, on the other hand, has seen an increase. And people think of chicken as the sort of healthy alternative to beef, and I wonder if that sort of informs people's choice of eating that and vegan and vegetarian options. Hackney, hello, Richard.
Hello, Nick. I mean, just as an aside, I think one of the things with beef is that it's just gone out of favour as a meat. It's very difficult to cook, and unless you're having it in mince.
Mm.
It just comes out, it's just dry and tough most of the time. It takes a lot of attention.
It's very hard to know what you're going to get, because one bite, even if it's a cut of the same meat, on one plate it can be tough and chewy, and on the other it can melt like butter, you just don't know what you're going to get.
I don't cook beef anymore, so... But what I called in to say was that I think the important thing to remember with this veganism and vegetarianism and everything else is that it doesn't have to be all or nothing. And I think that's really, I mean, I take my hat off to your commentator Saffron, who's like a strict vegan.
Mm.
That's great. We're not strict vegans.
Right.
But if you looked at the difference in our diet now and 10 years ago, the amount of meat we eat has just fallen away, and that's been a conscious thing.
So you're a flexitarian?
Pretty much. We're a sort of like, you know, this is going to sound silly, but we start out on Monday, vegan or vegetarian. Tuesdays and Wednesdays, meals with small amounts of meat. Thursdays, fish. Fridays, something fun for the kids. And then Saturdays and Sundays, great, roast dinners, go for it.
Right. And on the non-meat days, do you think, I wish there was some chicken under these potatoes?
Well, not really, because like a non-meat day, if I serve you a meal of jacket potatoes with sour cream and big beans and salad, are you Are you unhappy?
I would be delighted with that.
Yeah.
In fact, I'd like it right now.
Yeah. Or like a homemade pea soup or, or on the days with very little meat, even making pea soup with a ham stock.
And have you noticed a difference in your the way you feel, in your health?
Certainly my weight's gone down.
Right, okay.
But more than that, it's just a question of, it's not only trying to cut out meat for meat's sake, it's more a question of you have to think a bit more about how you cook, and you start looking at Italian recipes, and you realize that most Italian food actually uses really, really little meat. You know, it's just like a handful of pancetta or maybe a few slices of chorizo here, but the rest of it is just, other things. Tomatoes,
yes, it's not extravagant. Yeah, that's
garlic.
Right. It's not extravagant food, Italian food, is it? It's like farmyard food.
Yeah.
Richard, I've got to go, but thanks for that. Bristol, Tiago.
Oh, hi, Nick. Thanks for taking my call. I saw give some comment on why the UK has such a ultra-processed food culture compared to other places.
Yes.
I've worked in food advertising for a couple of years and spent a lot of time, kind of diving into all sorts of consumer behavior and food trends. And for me, my takeaway of it is a lot to do with land ownership and how the UK up to this day still has one of the most concentrated land ownerships in the whole of Europe.
Mm.
How so few people control so much of the land.
Yes.
And that also, if you think about post-war scarcity and the way that different countries reacted to that, the UK reacted by industrializing, by let's turn this into powder, let's put into tins, let's make it last long. That was the response to that scarcity through being such an industrialized country where other countries in Europe had a much more agrarian response by dividing land that used to belong to nobility and giving that land to people. So if you think about the average European person, and if you ask them how many degrees of separation they are from the land, I bet you be way less than any average British person.
Yeah,
how many degrees
almost
you have
certainly.
To go back?
Yes.
So
that's very interesting.
Once again, this is my conclusions based on a lot of data that I got from different places. But as someone who came from Brazil and grew up with a very close relationship to the land, one of my biggest shocks was how everything was wrapped in plastic when I arrived here.
Yes, and that can't be good for us. That was an interesting take. Tiago, I'm going to have to leave it there because I've got to take a break. Before we take a break, let's talk about the weather.
This is LBC with Nick Abbott.
An amber weather alert has been issued as what meteorologists are calling heavy and persistent rain threatens to swamp homes and put lives at risk. The rail network has already been disrupted by these conditions. Road users have experienced disruptions. Let's talk about this and the prospects for the rest of the year with Steph Galter, meteorologist at Square Raindrop, joins us on the line now. Hello, Steph.
Hello, Nick. Nice to be here.
Thanks very much for your time. Where's this rain coming from?
Well, it's what we call an atmospheric river. So it's come from quite a long way. It's come from down in the Azores. It's all firing up towards us. An atmospheric river is really very similar to a normal kind of river, but it's water vapor as opposed to actual water. And as it hits land, it just gives a load of rain. And this one's stalled. So that's why we're seeing all the problems. So over parts of Cumbria, parts of Wales, we are seeing an awful lot of rain and the ground's already saturated and some parts have already seen nearly the entire December average rainfall already. And then we've got this extra rain on top. So it is causing quite a few problems.
So it's not the effects of some faraway storm or is it?
No, I mean, partly it's caused by what's going on in the Americas at the moment. There's a very, very very cold air that's pooled over the northeast of Canada. The polar vortex is there, and that's caused a temperature difference, which in turn has fired across a very powerful jet stream across the Atlantic. Now, what that is doing is intensifying storms as they head their way towards us. So we've got this river of moisture heading its way towards us, and it's just dumping all of that rain in the western facing slopes, so where it hits land effectively and where it starts to go up over mountains and hills. So that's why we're seeing such a phenomenal amount of rain.
And this this cold snap that they're having in the north of America at the moment, because weather tends to come from that direction, is that what we can expect?
No, absolutely not. It's strangely mild at the moment, strangely mild for the time of year, and it's not expected to get particularly cold. What we're stuck in is this rut of very unsettled air all coming in from the west. So we're seeing lots of rain currently, as we've been hearing, but also come Wednesday, Thursday, we're expecting another batch of really heavy rain that could again cause some more flooding. So nothing particularly cold on the horizon, but certainly more in the way of wet weather.
Yeah, it is unusually clement for the time of year, isn't it? Or do we just associate this time of year with being cold, but it is often just like this, quite mild?
So it is often fairly mild and damp in December. If we get snow, it's usually after Christmas, even though we all hope for those kind of, you know, postcard kind of wintry scenes. But no, at this time of year, it is normally slightly milder, slightly wetter, slightly drizzlier. But this year has been unusually mild. So it is warmer than usual. It's not playing with your brain. But what we were expecting, or kind of hoping for really, is at the beginning of December, it looked like the long range forecast was hinting that it was all going to get quite cold. We might see some snow, but then it all changed. There was this quite a difference, a change in the forecast of the long range that happened just in the blink of an eye, really, a couple of days. And suddenly the long range changed from it looks like it's going to be cold to actually it's staying mild and pretty wet.
Yes. And so there's no chance of a picture, sort of a picture postcard or a picture Christmas card, more accurate, image for Christmas Day anywhere in the country. Is that right?
If I was a betting person, I'd keep my money in my pocket and not put a wager on a white Christmas. But after Christmas, you never know.
Well, I mean, you are best placed to answer that question. So what's going to happen after Christmas?
Well, after Christmas, there are a lot of sort of global drivers that would indicate that things might get colder. However, there are other things at play as well that mean it probably won't get too cold. So it's on a knife edge, really. If I was a betting person, I would probably say it's going to stay fairly mild. But a long range forecast, you know, it can change.
And the El Niño and the El Niño, have I got that right? They affect the weather in a fairly predictable way. What are they telling us about what might happen?
Well, we've got La Niña with us at the moment, which normally would indicate at the beginning of winter, at least, that it might be quite cold. But however, we then saw a sudden stratospheric warming, which sometimes would indicate that we're going to get some very cold air. But instead of being absorbed up into the stratosphere above us, it was reflected down. That had a major effect on the polar vortex, which is why it's cold in the northeast of Canada at the moment. And that's what then just amplified our weather and made sure things were mild and wet for us at the moment.
And because the direction of the wind is up from the south, is that right? That's what is keeping our temperature, you know, this sort of, it's practically balmy for December. And so there is no indication that it's going to switch at some point and the wind is going to come from what we're used to. It's more a northerly Arctic sort of temperatures.
Southwesterly is our prevailing wind, and that's what we're expecting over the next week or so, which is why it's going to stay mild. If we were going to have a cold snap, you're right, it would come down from the Arctic, screaming down from the north. But unfortunately, if you're hoping for snow, it doesn't look like we're going to see that anytime in the near future.
So can you give us a weather forecast then for as far ahead as you can see?
Certainly. So obviously, very, very wet at the moment. Gradually, that very heavy rain will sink down towards the southeast, sort of petering out as it does so. And then Tuesday looks a little bit calmer for some of us. before things pick up again later on Wednesday and into Thursday, and we see some heavy rain. And that could cause a problem with yet more flooding. Then after that, it stays unsettled. And it's not until nearly Christmas where there's a chance that we might see something slightly less unsettled, and we might see some slightly drier interludes. And after that, well, as I say, long-range forecast, I like to see the white of its eyes before I definitely put a wager on things.
Good to talk to you, Steph. Thanks very much for that. Steph Galter, meteorologist at Square Raindrop. Now we're going to take a short break then. It's off to America to talk to Simon Marks, LBC's Washington correspondent.
Coming up at one on LBC, Richard Spur.
A bill banning gay conversion therapies on the way, but what's your view on the practice? And what do the tragic events in Bondi say about the level of anti-Semitism today, both overseas and in the UK?
Richard Spur at one. Listen on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app.
When your deodorant has been reduced to a tiny whisper and tries to tell you,
I'm running on empty, I don't have much left to give.
No need to worry, your new deodorant is already on its way. Arriving today with Amazon Prime. Everyday essentials delivered fast. It's on Prime. Cut-off times and T's and C's apply. See product page when ordering.
Mate, did you know you could win £100 worth of points when you scan your BP Me Rewards card?
Yes.
And that can be spent on M&S or Amazon vouchers?
Yes.
Oh, what would I get? Oh, new shoes for Macy, socks for Dad, a scarf for Mum, bottle of red for
Scan your BP Me Rewards card with every purchase of BP and you could win £100 worth of points every hour. So, don't just scan, scan to win.
What would you get?
Fuel and earplugs.
Offer ends 2nd of January 2026. Participating stores only. T's and C's apply. For details, see bpmerewards.co.uk.
It's the most wonderful time of the year. Sky TV spectacular day of the Jackal, Amadeus and Barney Monroe. While on Netflix you'll see Emily in Paris, plus Stranger Things, so many shows.
Sorry, got a bit excited there. Get Sky TV and Netflix in time for Christmas for a most wonderful price. Go to sky.com. Sky, believe in better. Requires Sky Stream and relevant Sky TV subscriptions. Minimum broadband speed of 25 megabits per second recommended. 18 plus.
What should you put on your Christmas list this year?
Aldi! We're Quality Food Award Christmas Retailer of the Year for the 6th year in a row. And which cheapest supermarket of the year 4 years running? Get Christmas all wrapped up at Aldi. Visit aldi.co.uk/awards for more.
Britain's Conversation. Nick Abbott. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
Simon Marks is LBC's Washington correspondent and he joins us on the line now. Hello, Simon.
Evening, Nick.
So, Brown University, this is odd. This chap travelled from such a distance. It's like the middle of the country, Wisconsin. You have to go around the lakes for a start, and it's nigh on 2,000 miles. What do we know about why he did that?
It is very peculiar, and I think it's important to underscore, Nick, that first of all, the eyes of the country here, of course, have been on Australia, where the events of the last few hours have obviously, to some extent, driven attention away from the shooting that took place yesterday in Providence, Rhode Island, at Brown University, one of the country's most prominent liberal arts colleges, with now a person of interest having been detained by police. He is not currently officially under arrest. He is not even officially being described as being in custody. Simply, I mean, essentially the American version of police being helped in their inquiries by this 24-year-old individual. An army veteran, apparently, originally from Wisconsin. The Washington Post is reporting tonight that he may have lived for a time in Washington, D.C. He was detained at 4 o'clock in the morning at local time at a Hampton Inn hotel 20 miles south of Providence. We don't know precisely what led the FBI to that hotel, but they did discover weaponry there, including a gun with a laser pointer sight on it. It said that they tracked this individual's cell phone, and that may be how they lit upon his location. But how and when he made that very lengthy journey from Wisconsin to Providence, Rhode Island, and why he may have had an interest in attacking attacking students in the engineering department, the engineering campus on this liberal arts college as they were taking their final exams at the end of the first term of their university course is very, very unclear. And there's nervousness tonight, I think, still in Providence. There was a candlelit vigil there tonight for two dead students and the nine people injured in Saturday's attack. But for as long as no one's been charged in connection with this incident, there is obviously still nervousness among the community about whether, in fact, the authorities have got their man. Now, they're being told by the mayor of Providence tonight that there is no current reason to believe that there is an ongoing threat to Brown University or other targets in the Providence area. But nonetheless, I think there is going to be a tremendous amount of interest in this investigation as it advances to see whether this person of interest is ultimately charged or whether police determine that he was not involved in the events of Saturday. They obviously are still questioning him and very eager, clearly, to produce results in this case, given the enormous level of public interest, not just in Rhode Island itself, but nationally across the United States.
Yes, it is. There were some oddities about this, because initially the police said that they had apprehended a person of interest. That's their phrase. And then they unapprehended him. They said, no, forget that. It's not him. And so is that the same person that you're talking about, or were there two separate persons of interest?
Well, I think it's not the same person, and it was Brown University itself that put that initial report out saying that a suspect was in custody, which led to many of the students who had been sheltering in place within the university thinking that perhaps it was safe for them to leave the places in which they'd been sheltering. And then minutes later, Brown University put out a corrective saying, actually, no one was in custody. And it was many, many hours later that this individual was apprehended in that hotel 20 miles away from the site of the shooting. So it seems very unlikely that it was the same individual that Brown University was referring to. I think the university is under some pressure. And you know, to be fair, for any university or educational institution or public institution in the United States to have to go through the trauma of the last 24 hours must be unbelievably difficult. But they also put out a second message on social media reporting gunfire in another part of the city that they then later retracted. The president of the university was not present in Rhode Island yesterday, returned home from, I think, Washington, D.C. about 6 hours later, and faced some pretty hostile questions from local media officials about why she still appeared to have so little information about where students were sheltering in place, where the attack had begun. So I think the university is going to be facing a critique of its response to this tragedy. But again, these institutions, and they all go through routines now. They go through drills, emergency shelter-in-place drills for eventualities like this. But nonetheless, it must be incredibly difficult to find yourself suddenly, in real time, having to respond, but also having to worry about the sanctity and safety of the student body. And also, Nick, the realization here today that two of the students caught up in this incident yesterday, neither of them injured, but two of the students caught up in this incident yesterday had previously survived school shootings in the United States. I mean, that gives you a real sense now of how many of these incidents there are, how prevalent mass gun violence is.
Yes.
That kids whose time in school was pockmarked by having to endure the crisis of a mass gun attack on a school in their communities, then go to university and they find it on their university doorstep as well.
Well, the statistics, shootings in America are absolutely astonishing. The mass shooting, as in more than three or four people get shot in one incident, happens every day in America. And a school shooting happens every week. So it is only an extraordinary, in an extraordinary circumstance that it even makes the news in America.
Yes, I mean, I have to say, when I learned that these two young people had been caught up in high school shootings and then found themselves witnessing events at Brown University yesterday, in a way I was thinking, well, I'm surprised it's not more than two, because there are now so many of these mass gun incidents. And we've seen, I think it is safe to say, the predictable response.
I know what they're saying. Before you say it, I know what they'll say. They'll say it's too early to talk about gun control and thoughts and prayers.
Absolutely. Thoughts and prayers very much emanating from the White House this weekend for the students killed and those injured at Brown University. Thoughts and prayers also being sent in the direction of Bondi Beach. But, of course, absolutely no move whatsoever. No discussion, not a scintilla of a mention of the need to reignite the conversation about gun control here. And the political calculus on Capitol Hill just has not changed a jot. And it will not change as a result of this terrible situation at Brown University, and it won't change as a result of the next one either.
Now, let's talk about something a little bit lighter. The price of the World Cup tickets. Now, of course, FIFA bent over backwards in order to hose Donald Trump down with flattery. They even went so far as to invent a little pony plastic peace prize that they gave him. But it's the price of the World Cup tickets that are exercising people now.
Yes, absolutely. Five times higher than the prices of World Cup tickets 4 years ago. And just to break this down, if there is an England fan out there who is thinking of travelling across the Atlantic to attend the World Cup next year, if England were to reach the final, the cheapest ticket prices that that fan would have to pay cumulatively would total $4,185, and they could go as high as $8,680. That's before you've paid for the flight. It's before you've paid for hotel accommodation, for transport to the venues and back from the venues. And, you know, even if there were England fans willing to shell out that kind of money for those kind of ticket prices, of course there are fans from all sorts of less affluent nations around the world that are looking at these eye-watering prices. All sorts of calls now for investigations, for FIFA to come forward and justify this pricing. They say that it is in line with special event pricing for other similar major global events.
Right.
But then when you layer on top of that the potential difficulty that certainly folks from the UK may have, even getting travel authorization to come to the United States, if you have to fork over 5 years of social media history to the Americans, maybe even your DNA, as the Trump administration seems to want, the price of coming to attend the World Cup in many ways is going to be astronomical.
Yeah, that is right. I'll watch it on TV like everybody else. Always a pleasure, Simon. Thanks for that. Simon Marks, LBC's Washington correspondent. Now, if you missed any of today's show, you can listen back on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app, on which you can read and watch the latest from LBC. You can put your news categories in the order you want. You can pause and rewind live radio and listen to a boatload of podcasts, in amongst which you will find Three of Mine. If you don't have it, it's free. Get LBC's app from your app store now. I'll be back Friday, Saturday, Sunday night at 10. Coming up at 4 on LBC, it's Ian Payne. But first, Richard Spur.
Good morning. Still to come, a draft bill to ban the practice of gay conversion therapy will be published before the end of the current parliament, according to the government. I'll be asking what you think of that practice and what having a non-binary sexuality has meant to you. But first, the gunman behind a shooting targeting the Jewish community at a Hanukkah event on Bondi Beach, were a father and son. Sun, Australian officials say. 15 people, including a 10-year-old girl, were killed in the attack, which Prime Minister Anthony Albanese called an act of anti-Semitism and terrorism on our shores. So this morning, what is your reaction to yesterday's tragic events? And is anti-Semitism becoming even more of a malicious presence right here in Britain itself? 0345 6060 973.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom. Police forces across the UK are expected to put more officers into Jewish communities following the anti-Semitic gun attack at Bondi Beach in Australia. 15 people were killed, plus a shooter. His 24-year-old son has been arrested. The Australian Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, has been telling a news conference the country will rally round.
This was an attack deliberately targeted at the Jewish community on the first day of Hanukkah, which, of course, should be a joyous celebration. And the Jewish community are hurting today. Today, all Australians wrap our arms around them and say, we stand with you.
The dead were aged between 87 and 10 years old. The Australian journalist Diane Coveney-Garland has been telling LBC this weekend's events have been seismic.
This is a huge death toll. This is going to change Australia as we know it. And It just seems like police, I wouldn't suggest they're being cagey, but they're just keeping their cards close to their chest until they get more information. But it's just, you just needed to look at the Prime Minister or the Premier this morning. They just look downtrodden, downcast.
The head of the UK's armed forces is to warn the general security situation in the world is the most dangerous he's seen in his career. Sir Richard Knighton's speech later on today will also say the growing threat means the whole nation must step up. It's being reported Ukraine's